It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Great panel for you. Science fiction author Cory Doctorow is here. He's joined by Tim Stevens from CNET and from Protocol.com, Owen Thomas. Lots to talk about. We'll get the guy's ideas on what Elon should do when he finally gets a hold of Twitter. Why Web.3 is not going that great. In fact, how the latest plan to sell, what was it, Bored Apes brought Ether down. And Cory will show us his femur. He's going to make a walking stick out of it. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 873, recorded Sunday, May 1st, 2022. A little patience and a lot of tape. This episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by Podium. Join more than 100,000 businesses that already use Podium to streamline their customer interactions. Get started for free at podium.com/twit or sign up for a paid Podium account and get a free credit card reader. Restrictions apply. And by Our Crowd. Our Crowd helps accredited investors invest early in pre-IPO companies alongside professional venture capitalists. Join the fastest-growing venture capital investment community at ourcrowd.com/twit. And by Nareva. Traditional audio conferencing systems can entail lots of components. Installation can take days, and you might not get the mic coverage you need. That's complexpensive. But Nareva Audio is easy to install and manage. No technicians required, and you get true full room coverage. And that's easy economical. Learn more at Nareva.com. And by UserWay.org. UserWay is the world's number one accessibility solution, and it's committed to enabling the fundamental human right of digital accessibility for everyone. When you're ready to make your site compliant, deciding which solution to use is an easy choice. Go to userway.org/twit for 30% off UserWay's AI-powered accessibility solution. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. I had to bring in the big brains for this one. No one can figure out what the hell's going on with Elon Musk and Twitter. Tim Stevens is here, editor-in-chief of the newly christened CNET Cars, formerly Roadshow. Still there, still editor-in-chief. Great to see you, Tim.
Great to see you too, Leo. Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
And you told me you had a good winter. Here we are on May Day, so I guess the ice racing is over in Upper New York State. I'm hoping.
Yeah, it's been a couple of weeks since we've had any ice. Yeah, we're still waiting for really things to thaw. We just had snow last week, so it's wow. It's still hanging on there, though.
Wow. As Jonathan Colton says, no, I better not. It is all. It's May. No more snow driving begins today. That's what he says. Sure. Owen Thomas is here from Protocol. Hello, Owen Thomas. Yeah, he's doing the full Isaac. Good to see you.
How are you?
I'm great. You're in Virginia now, not in the Bay Area.
My native land.
Oh.
Fairfax County, Virginia.
Oh, that's horse country, isn't it?
It was maybe 40 years ago. It's now suburbia.
Everything, for me, all my references are at least 40 years old, so you'll forgive me for that.
All is forgiven.
Also with us, the science fiction novelist and big thinker, Mr. Cory Doctorow from Pluralistic.net. Always good to see you, Cory. Thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure. Nice to see you, too.
If anybody could figure out what Elon Musk should do with Twitter, it would be Cory Doctorow.
Yeah. I don't think he'd like my answer, but we'll talk.
Oh, well, let's talk. let's talk. EFF has written already a piece. Twitter has a new owner. This is Gillian York and Jenny Gebhart and Jason Kelly and David Green combining their great minds. Here's what he should do. It's pretty clear Elon doesn't have a clue what he should do. He knows what he wants to do, but they're kind of mutually conflicting ideas. Things like get rid of spam bots and protect free speech, which are mutually exclusive.
Yeah, you know, there's this thing that people do where when they don't know much about a complicated subject, they say, it's so simple, I don't know why you're not doing it. It's really obvious. that all you should do is X. That I remember, I was just thinking about this the other day. I read a book when I was a kid, a kid's book, where the premise was that the protagonist had figured out how to predict the weather 10 years out. And the way that they did it is they just asked the meteorologist what they did to predict the weather one day out, and then they just doubled it and tripled it until they got to 10 years. And this whole thing, like, I want to reduce the amount of people who get banned, and I also want to ban anyone who I think is a bot, is a really good example of just not really understanding what you're talking about. And I think, you know, the argument that Twitter should have all the things that are legally allowed in America is clearly not a good plan.
Well, for right? one thing, Twitter isn't just in America. That was what he told Chris Anderson in his interview at TED was, well, oh, it's easy. You just free speech abide means anything that's not illegal. Laws. Yeah, abide by
that. Yeah, them. And so, you know, I think that every conversational space has some limits. And, you know, it is true that, like, setting a limit for 100 million people is really hard. It's even harder to do it for 3 billion, which is one of the reasons Facebook kind of sucks, right? And you know, I think a lot of people are like, the problem with Facebook is that Mark Zuckerberg is the wrong person to set the conversational policies for 3 billion people speaking 1,000 languages in 100 countries. And I think the right answer is, like, nobody should have that job. And, you know, America has an approach to this that, as someone who's not an American but was just called up for my citizenship interview, I'm quite fond of, which is federalism, which is the idea that there's some, like, minimum standards that we have for what we want. And then we devolve control to smaller groups of people who set their own rules. And we make it really easy to go from one group to the other. So the states can set a bunch of rules for themselves that are different. I like living in California, for example, where non-compete agreements are illegal. You know, it's really easy to move to California. So you can move to California and you just will never be subjected to a non-compete, which is good. And it's a way to find out, you know, how people want to live and what works and what doesn't. The laboratory of democracy, as they say. And, you know, allowing Twitter users to leave Twitter but continue to exchange messages with it by having a federated system where you had people who ran their own servers that if they met a certain standard, you know, about privacy and about certain other things, maybe doxing and so on, they could continue to interchange messages. And then, you know, within their own communities, they would set up their own rules. And you might have a Twitter community of your own. You might have a...
Sounds like you're describing Mastodon.
It's, well, the problem with Mastodon is that everyone is already on Twitter. And so there's a really high switching cost.
Right. Right.
You have to convince all the people you want to talk to on Twitter
but
to go to Mastodon.
Don't you worry that part of the problem is simply scale, that if everybody who was on Twitter went to Mastodon, similar problems would rear their ugly heads?
If they went to one Mastodon server, for sure. If they went to 10,000 Mastodon servers, there would be interesting new gnarly problems like, you know, is it whitelisting or blacklisting when people create a new server? What are the terms on which?
Yeah, when I created my server, I did not interoperate with gab.com, which is a right-wing version of Mastodon. And another server, which shall remain nameless.
Truth Social or something?
Yeah, well, now Truth Social is running on Mastodon, but are they federating? They're not federating.
I don't know if they're federating or not. You're right. I mean, if Mastodon's got a really interesting moderation.
I moderate my instance.
Yeah, but as a user, so I use Quadrature de Net's one, which is memo.fr. They're the French equivalent of EFF or French analog to EFF. And I like them because, you know, they stand up for your speech, right? I thought they'd be a good place to be. And they federate with a lot of people. And I noticed that there were people who were actual Nazis in my mentions who were on servers with names like, you know, white supremacy dot something or other. And I could just block the whole server. So I just
as
said,
an
like,
individual, you can block an entire server. See, that's great.
Yeah. So they, you know, that's a set of policies that I like. It's really easy for me to quit Quadrature de Net and go to a different server if I want a different set of policies and to automatically have everyone who's following me there move their follow to somewhere else. So my switching costs are really low. You know, there's a study, a preprint that just came out that's going to be presented at CHI this year, the Computer-Human Interaction Conference that Usenix puts on, about people who left WhatsApp when they changed their privacy policy in 2021 and installed Signal. And there were several million people who did this. And the researchers surveyed over 1,000 of them to get a good representative sample. And what they found is that only about 20% managed to shift any of their conversations to Signal. Like, that is, got anyone from WhatsApp that they wanted to talk to leave WhatsApp and move to Signal. And of those, 0.5% of them managed to actually delete WhatsApp and move all the conversations that mattered to them to Signal. So switching costs are really high. They make it really hard to leave one service. They keep other services from popping up. Interoperability and federation make switching costs really low. You don't have to convince all your friends to leave. You just, like, literally 100% of the people who installed Signal could have immediately deleted WhatsApp, because it wouldn't matter if the people they wanted to talk to had left WhatsApp, because they could still talk to them from Signal.
That's the key, interoperability. Absolutely. Yeah. Tim Stevens, are you a Twitter user?
Yeah, I definitely am. And it's been an interesting week for sure. I've definitely lost a lot of followers this week, which I think is really unfortunate. I think it's very, very early for people to be making such a drastic measure to be, you know, deleting their accounts. We really don't know how this is going to shake out, or even if it's going to pass. I mean, there's still every possibility that Musk is going to just change his mind.
There is one theory that Musk will just walk away from this. He doesn't really, although he sold, I think, $8 billion worth of Tesla stock since this offer. He's got to come up with $21 billion personally, so there's a lot more to go still. So,
and he said he's not selling more Tesla stock.
Yeah, he can't.
I'm little curious about the math.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Tim, your point of view is the wait-and-see point of view. I'm going to see what happens.
It is for now. And ultimately, you know, I think Twitter is an important enough platform that to simply walk away is to basically, you know, throw up your hands in defeat. If you want to have some say in what happens going forward, then I think that you need to ultimately stay and voice your opinion on what Twitter should be. I think Corey's got a lot of great ideas, and it'd be wonderful to have some of those implemented. For sure, if I could immediately step away to something like Mastodon and have my audience come with me, then I probably would do that as well. But obviously, that's not something that we can do. I am definitely very concerned. I mean, Musk on one day was saying he didn't want to be political, and then the next day he's tweeting out political memes, which were quite short-sighted, in my opinion. So I have a lot of concerns about what that means for, you know, having someone like that at the core of the brand.
Right.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to turn this, what I think is a very important social platform, into an untenable solution. And I'm optimistic that if enough folks stay behind, enough folks are keen on having it remain what it is, which is basically an open platform for discussion on all subjects with reasonably okay moderation, then I hope that we can continue to improve the situation and not make it worse.
Yeah, Twitter is made up of the people who tweet on it, not the people who own it.
So far.
Yeah. How about you, Owen?
Well, this is the insane thing. You know, Elon Musk says Twitter has a problem because, like, Taylor Swift isn't tweeting. And then he's doing everything he can to make it as unpleasant as possible for someone like Taylor Swift to be on Twitter by his stated plan.
The reason those top 10 tweeters don't tweet very much is it's a hostile environment for them. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, there's no payback.
It's
there's
brutal.
No
it's brutal.
Benefit.
Yeah.
So they use it as kind of one-way broadcast. You know, they've got a new record that's dropping. You know, there's a new music video. They tell their followers, you know, go wild for a second. And they don't stay to interact because there's nothing in it for them. They don't get value.
Right.
Elon has zero plan to
people
to
pointed this out. There are smaller communities on Twitter. Black Twitter is the one most people use as an example, where they're somewhat insular, and they are really important to the people who are members of those communities. I'm sure there are many more. I'd hate to lose that for those people. And I don't think anything Elon's thinking about doing is going to make that less tenable, or is it, Corey? What are the dangers of what Elon might do?
Well, I mean, here's the thing that I think we should take away from this, which is that when Twitter was run by a board of, like, however many, 8 extremely wealthy tech people, it was not well managed to the extent that those were the 8 people who decided to sell it to Elon Musk.
Right.
So if you think
that Elon... And by the way, he points out that none of them were real Twitter users.
Right. So, but if you think Elon Musk shouldn't be in charge of Twitter, then perforce you should think that the people who put him in charge of Twitter
shouldn't have been
also shouldn't be in charge of Twitter.
Right.
Right.
Well, ultimately, the shareholders are who is going to decide whether he gets it. He still has to get a shareholder vote.
Sure, that's very true. But I think that, you know, there are lots of ways that Twitter could become really awful. So, you know, this human verification thing, there are lots of ways that it can go very wrong. Basically, Musk is proposing to do in some way to gather a gigantic amount of potentially compromising personal identifying information, because uniquely identifying and disambiguating 100 million people in 1,000 countries, or 100 countries rather, is a really big job. And it's going to involve either government ID or biometrics
and
or
something.
And
he's not averse to that, because Tesla gathers all the information about every drive.
Sure. Now,
I remember when I had a Model X order in, I felt like I shouldn't say anything about Elon because a well-known blogger did say something negative about Tesla, and Elon canceled his order. So he's not a free speech.
Very capricious, right?
He's capricious. So, that's a better word than anything, yeah.
So you know, if Musk says, well, what we should do is aggregate all this potentially sensitive personal identifying information and then never leak it, he's being extremely optimistic, right, and rather reckless. Now 15 years ago, I wrote a column where I compared personal identifying information to uranium and plutonium. Because I grew up in Ontario where we mine a lot of the world's uranium. And when uranium comes out of the ground, it's pretty benign. You can actually like buy it on Amazon for science fair projects. But once you refine it into plutonium, it's immortal. Like, it will last longer than any human institution or built object. It is like pluripotent, right? There's no amount of it that's so small that it won't kill you. So you can't unmake it, and it is infinitely toxic. And if you pile up all of that PII, it will end up kind of slithering around within and outside of Twitter. Like, the only way to keep data from leaking is to neither retain it nor collect it, ideally. And that exposes a lot of people to risk. So that's just like one example of what it means to have like a dilettante show up.
Well, it even crosses my mind that may be part of the, because one of the questions is how is he going to make any money on this? This is a huge expense. No one's ever made money on Twitter. How does he justify this expense? Maybe the information is the point.
Well, I think he doesn't know what he's doing. I think that he's someone who's extremely narcissistic. You know, I'm not trying to diagnose him at a distance, but this is the guy who didn't found Tesla and bought it from people who did found Tesla, and as part of the contract made them promise that they would call him a co-founder even though he wasn't.
Yeah.
That's a really weird thing. He also calls himself the chief engineer of Tesla, even though he's not an engineer at Tesla. And when you write about, if you're a journalist and you write about the chief engineer of Tesla, their PR department will contact you and say, you'll find that Elon is the chief engineer of Tesla. The person you're talking about is like the chief operating engineer.
He's the guy who does the work.
Elon wears the engineer hat and gets to pull the whistle on the railroad. So he thinks he's the engineer, right? It is a really bizarre circumstance. So I don't know. He's pretty chaotic, right? He does a lot of chaotic things. I think that he's got poor impulse control. I think he's a very good showman. And I think that he doesn't really know what he's getting Twitter for. I've heard some theories that I think are kind of plausible. Like, if he has Twitter, he can use it as like a PR vehicle for his other stuff.
Yes, you know, Twitter, but not $44 billion worth.
I mean, he could do that for free right now.
Yeah. He doesn't have to buy Twitter to do that.
But you know, so here's my Elon Musk story. One day I was on Twitter and someone retweeted Elon Musk saying, I consider myself a utopian socialist in the mode of Ian Banks. So a science fiction writer who's dead. And I couldn't help it. And I replied and I said, I knew Ian. He was an ardent trade unionist. The National Labor Review Board has sanctioned you like four times in the last 3 months. I don't think you can call yourself a utopian socialist in the mode of Ian Banks. And we got into a really dumb argument where he said things like, well, there aren't any unions in Banks's culture novels. And I said, yes, they're set on solar system-sized spaceships that travel thousands of times the speed of light, that have a trillion people living on them, and are piloted by superhuman AIs. And he said, you know, well, if Ian could have seen one of my factories, he'd see that it doesn't need a union either.
Oh, there is a world of difference.
Difference between faster than light travel and eking out marginal gains in the production of electric vehicles. And then he called me an enemy of humanity, I think.
Oh, my God.
But here's the thing that was really weird about it. That part wasn't weird. That was just like, oh, he's just a crank. But the part that was really weird was all the bots that follow Elon to try and put him on tilt. I actually think this is a lot of it. There are for sure 100% shorts who try to put Elon on tilt with bots that just troll him night and day.
And vice versa, I might add. He has his own bot army.
That is may entirely be true. I mean, there were a lot of like notice me senpai people in there who I don't think were bots. I think that they were, you know, sad fanboys. But the actual like inauthentic conduct, right? Like just hundreds of bots that showed up that I had to block before I could even read my timeline after being mentioned by Musk.
Exactly.
And I still get them.
Yeah, I still get them.
Like this is 5 years later, and I still like a couple of times a week will have to block a bot that just goes through everything Musk has ever tweeted and tweets weird, horrendous garbage to see if they can put him on tilt so that short positions. I think so. Short positions can pay off. Maybe because they're just trolls. Who knows?
Right.
So I think that like some of what he's motivated by, all this stuff about like we have to get rid of the bots, is that he has got this unbelievably specific thing. It's like if he suddenly was like real, like he bought all of CVS because he wanted the special shampoos used to treat hair plugs to be more, you know, prominently featured.
They should have end caps.
Because they're really hard to find, and it's a problem for people. And it was just really, it's just a problem for him, you know?
You know, Corey, I think you're really onto something there, because Elon really got active on Twitter to, like, fight with Tesla short sellers.
Yes.
So the idea that they're, you know, they're ginning him up, you know, like egging him on, it's actually pretty plausible.
I think they make his life miserable.
That's all he's trying to do is get rid of that.
Yeah.
I asked Corey what Elon could do to screw Twitter up. Let me ask you, Tim Stevens, what Elon could do to make Twitter better. I put you in the spot, didn't I? Honestly feel like, you know, they always say, no plan survives the first encounter with the enemy. I really think that Elon's plans to free speech, open the algorithm, and get rid of the bots is only going to last as long as until he gets in the chair, and then who knows what he's going to do. What should he do?
I mean, I think the number one thing is what Corey was talking about earlier, which would be the ability to take your audience with you to another platform if you want to. But since we've already covered that ground, I think ultimately it has to be much, much better moderation tools and much smarter moderation as well. As I consume Twitter on my phone and on my desktop and a couple of other platforms as well. And as I go from one to the other, I'll actually see different sets of tweets because my phone has a different level of basically profanity filter and other filters than other platforms do, which just kind of shows how weak Twitter is at actually keeping you from seeing abusive content, even if it's light stuff. So I think if Musk really wants to open the floodgates and let everybody back on, then ultimately they need a lot better tools to give me the power to control what I want to see and what I don't want to see, whether it be misinformation, whether it be hate speech, whether it be whatever. As of now, depending on which platform I go to, all that stuff gets through. And I have it relatively easy compared to a lot of folks who I know who have, you know, a lot of people who are saying very mean things to them. So if he's really going to open the floodgates in the name of quote unquote free speech, then moderation tools need to improve significantly.
Tools for end users as well to control what they see. Mike Masnick made an excellent point on Tech Dirt, saying Elon is essentially saying what people said at the beginning of Twitter before they really had a Twitter, and he's just going to throw out 15 years of struggling with moderating a platform like this and all the knowledge gained there. It sounds like Elon's just saying, no, you guys, I got an idea. Let's do it better. I don't want to go on and on about Elon, but somebody in the chat room is saying somebody should defend Elon. I guess it's you, Owen. Defend the man. I mean, look, he created SpaceX. Amazing, right? Tesla has changed the world for electric vehicles.
Which someone else founded.
I understand, but he certainly took it. And, you know, you could also make the argument he did it with government grants, but he's taken to electric vehicles into the mainstream. Thank you, Elon. SpaceX is pretty cool. They landed those two rockets like that. That was cool. They're certainly better than NASA or the Russians.
Using Space a lot Federation. Of NASA technology.
Okay.
Though.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Right? They wouldn't exist without NASA the same way Apple wouldn't exist without the DOD.
You know, Elon is basically kind of a Steve Jobsian character where, no, he didn't invent any of this, but he's a master marketer.
Yeah.
Granted,
yeah,
absolutely. And I think as soon as Elon Musk can realize his plan to get a human to Mars, he should do it.
Go, Elon, go.
You know, the last time we played that Penelope Scott song about Elon Musk.
Yes.
Still is the thing that I come back to whenever I think about him, because she does capture that ambivalence that you're expressing.
Yeah.
About
it's difficult.
You know, what he's got.
I drove a Tesla for a long time. I really love the fact that he made it, and I'll only drive electric vehicles from now on. I love the fact that he made that mainstream. I don't know if that's his past and his future is more chaotic, or if this is just the guy all along. I can tell you one thing. Both the good and the bad of Twitter is it takes people like you, Corey, and brings you out into the fracas of the modern world. And it's one of the reasons I stopped using Twitter is it's almost inevitable that you get in a battle eventually and maybe say things that you regret eventually. And I don't think anybody benefits from being on Twitter as much as they benefit from not being on Twitter. Maybe that's what Elon will do for Twitter. Kick us all off. I wouldn't mind that either.
I mean, I like Twitter. Maybe that's an unpopular opinion, but
very popular. No. I try to convince people how awful Twitter is all the time, and nobody will.
But I think people on Twitter like to talk about how much they don't like it. I can name some things about Twitter that I think should be fixed in terms of like content moderation and stuff. I got dogpiled at one point by this. It was hilarious. I wrote about police violence, and this cop said, "Well, why don't you come along for a ride along, and you know, and I'll show you what it's really like." And it was just like this kind of bad faith response to a pretty subtle and significant argument I made, and I just blocked him. And so then he quote tweeted it, or he screen capped the block, and he had like 12,000 or 20,000 followers, and said, "Hey, this guy hates cops. Why don't you gang up on him and tell him what a piece of shit is?" And then I just got like literally thousands of like, "I want to come over to your house and kill you" kind of tweets. Like, "I hope the Burbank police, I hope someone murders you in Burbank and the Burbank police department don't do anything about it." And I was like, yeah, this is definitely a guy I should have gone on a ride along with, because he's really proved himself to be kind and the kind of person who I'd learn a lot from. But the point was, there was no easy way to block it. I tried using a bunch of tools like Block Together to block all of this guy's followers, to just say like, if you're following this, like, ghastly monster of a human, I just don't want to ever hear from you. And all of those tools tripped Twitter's "you are doing too much automated stuff" filters.
Yeah, right.
And they locked me out of my account. Right. So that was like a compounding failure. Like, there are a bunch of things like that if you're like a Twitter power user. I'm sure everyone's got like half a dozen of these.
I should point out, you accomplished your goal though, because you're off Twitter. That worked.
Right, you know, right.
It was how you wanted to accomplish it.
Well, no, they could still reply to me. I could read it. I just couldn't block them.
Just couldn't do anything.
Right.
Yeah.
It just locked my account. So it was like, it was a stupid, it's stupid edge case fail in their like moderation stuff. There are a bunch of things that I could completely see building that would be really good. You know, one of the things that Twitter did that I was very skeptical of, and now I'm like, oh my God, that was brilliant, is hide as an option. So if someone replies to you, you can hide their reply. And so what people see when they go to your tweet is they see there are some hidden replies, which they can click and see. And what that does is often the worst kinds of arguments are the ones where it's just people trolling in foolish ways. And it just means that everyone ends up talking about something that's not very interesting.
Yeah.
And also like just generates a lot more heat than light. And what I can do, I think of myself as, you know, if I have a tweet that gets a lot of retweets and so on, I think of myself as someone who instigated a conversation. And the way that I can express my duty to that conversation to try and make it good is I can hide the stuff that I think is dumb. And the people who want to read it can, and they can reply to it if they want. But unless you take an extra step, you don't see it. You're not tempted to reply to it. And the actual caliber of the conversation goes up. So if you're someone who like kicks off big, interesting Twitter conversations, they've produced some pretty simple and innovative tools that actually make those conversations better.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a lot of stuff on Twitter that I really rather like. And then there's a bunch of stuff that I don't like, too. I just would like Twitter. I just think that some of the hard Twitter calls to make about what should and shouldn't be permitted are calls that are much better made among small communities, right? One of the constant failure modes of Twitter and all social media is the inability to distinguish speech from counter speech. So there's a big difference between that guy calling someone the N-word and saying, I can't believe I just got called the N-word.
Right.
And yet both of those tend to trip the same filter. And so that's a really big problem, especially since people who's like, you know, burning passion in life is figuring out how to hurl racial slurs at people can have all day long to think up euphemisms for the N-word or putting, you know, words in brackets to indicate Jew or whatever. And then the people who they're actually targeting have just want to live their lives. And so they're the ones who aren't going to use the euphemisms and are going to get killed by the algorithm or by the moderators who are over busy or moderating in languages they don't speak. And the actual like bad actors you're trying to catch are the ones who don't. And really the people who can distinguish speech from counter speech are the people in the affected community, and letting them find their own place where they can talk and set their own rules and decide what they do and don't block is, I think the only way we can answer this. It's not like we have to add more pages to the three-ring binder that has the moderation policies and have enough branching if-thens that we cover all potential conversational possibilities, right? We just need people who understand the context to be the ones in charge of determining what stays and what goes.
That does not scale well, and that's really the problem. So you're saying small Mastodon instances,
It federates, yeah.
Federates.
It doesn't scale, federates.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, yeah. Figuring out what to have for dinner doesn't scale, which is why we don't try and come up with a single menu plan for the whole country, right?
Jack Dorsey and the Blue Sky Project, he was working on something that sounded like it was sort of federated. Do any of you know what Blue Sky
was? I learned something cool about Blue Sky, which is that they have a $15 million endowment and no oversight from Twitter. So it actually doesn't matter who runs Twitter. Blue Sky gets to go on. Now, who runs Twitter matters a lot if Blue Sky makes something and Twitter decides not to use it, right? Like that Twitter is under no obligation to use whatever Blue Sky comes up with because they're not part of Twitter formally. But it also means that if Twitter changes their mind or comes under new management, they can't be hamstrung, at least not in their development work. Their rollout can obviously be hamstrung by whoever is running Twitter.
They and it's in say, it's in Blue Sky's mission to do it decentralized. I mean, that's the key to it, right?
They had this idea that they called an app store for moderation, which I mean, that's an interesting way of phrasing it. I don't know that I don't know exactly where that fits. I'd be interested to see what they come out with when they come out with it. I knew some of the people involved when it was getting started up, and they were people I thought very highly of. So, you know, I'm glad to see Blue Sky kind of rolling along. The other thing we should mention is the Digital Markets Act in the European Union and the Access Act in the U.S. DMA initially only affects end-to-end messenger services, but eventually will cover social media. And Access Act will cover social media, although not Twitter. It's not big enough. We talk a lot about Twitter. Twitter is incredibly tiny. It's 100 million users versus 3 billion on Facebook.
Right.
Like it's not. But
these
it's
are
not
both
in any of those
houses. Laws to encourage interoperability, right?
To require it.
Require it.
Yeah. To say like if someone shows up. So what it would do is it would say, if Twitter showed up at Facebook's door or Mastodon or you or me and said, I want to interoperate, they would have to like expose an API to us that would let our users exchange messages and be in communities with Facebook users.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you have to have 75 billion euros of worth.
That's to be mandated.
Oh, that's to be mandated. Okay.
Mandate.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's the other end of it. So like there's a
so they could go to Facebook. I see what you're saying.
Yeah,
Facebook couldn't come to Twitter and say you have to interoperate, but Twitter
could go to Facebook.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right. I want to take a little break. We're done with the Elon Musk, although I really was looking forward to your story, Owen Thomas, about how you got in a battle with Elon over having to refile his S1.
Oh, yeah. That was a saga.
Was that on a Twitter stage or was that somewhere else?
Well, the interesting thing is he's kind of in a similar pickle now in that he has been borrowing against his Tesla shares. And there could be a real problem if Tesla shares keep dropping in value. But the situation was Tesla was trying to go public. It had a big loan from that I think was backed by the U.S. government, special bonds that it had issued. And one of the requirements was that Elon not sell or give away a certain number of his shares. Well, he was in the middle of a messy, contested divorce, and the divorce settlement could potentially have breached that agreement. And that would have had cascading bad effects on Tesla, and he wasn't disclosing it to shareholders. Does this sound familiar?
Yeah.
Elon Musk not making the needed disclosures?
Yeah.
So I reported that. He made it all about, oh, this, you know, scuzzy journalist is digging into my divorce. And I'm like, no one would care about your divorce if it didn't have the risk of directly affecting your finances.
So he had to write a post. Given the choice, I'd rather stick a fork in my hand than write about my personal life, says Elon Musk. Unfortunately,
oh, yeah.
I have to. Thanks to you, Owen Thomas. You, I blame you. All right.
It was delightful fact checking that. I wrote in a piece. I got out my red pen and crossed through every false claim he made.
Oh Lord.
So called correcting the record piece.
Yes.
It was entertaining.
Yeah. Let's take a little break. Come back with more great panel. I promise you, we're done with Twitter. Tim Stevens, editor in chief of the newly named CNET Cars, formerly Roadshow. Same great content. We also thank you for being here, as always. From Protocol, we've got Owen Thomas, new place to be, relatively, senior editor over there, and it's great to have you. I love Protocol. You've been doing a great job. Free, which I love, although you can subscribe and get newsletters and stuff. And Cory Doctorow, sci-fi author, his latest, Attack Surface, doing well?
Yeah, doing very well. I mean, it's been a while since I've given it much thought. I have 8 books in production right now.
Holy cow.
So I'm living as science fiction writers should in the future.
Yes. You're writing your next one, I'm sure. Unauthorized Bread is the subject of our Stacey's Book Club in Club Twit. I mentioned this before, coming up later. Did I miss it? Oh, shoot.
It happened. Yeah, that was very exciting.
So, next one is Termination Shock. That's right. We already did Unauthorized Bread.
Also a good book. I read that book when I was in Rotterdam seeing the giant dam that he wrote it about.
Cool. That's kind of cool. Yeah. If you're not a Club Twit member, lots of stuff coming up. Thursday, Scott Wilkinson has an Ask Me Anything. The following Thursday, Father Robert Ballasaire with a fireside chat. Stacey's Book Club is coming up June 16th. But that's just part of what you get in Club Twit. Ad-free versions of all of our shows. Access to the Club Twit Discord, where there is always a good conversation going on about all kinds of things. And many, many animated GIFs. Also, you get the Twit Plus feed with conversations from before and after the show. And also shows that don't make it into the regular feeds, like the Untitled Linux Show. Stacey's Book Club, The Giz Fizz. We are launching a new show soon. Stay tuned for that. Because club members pay, we are able to launch shows without advertising. That really helps us launch new shows. This Week in Space came out of the club. So thank you, club members. $7 a month. Club Twit. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit. Thank you in advance. Our show today brought to you by Podium. I'll tell you what. I think the merchants in Petaluma have discovered Podium. I love it when I go to our local ice cream store, and as I'm leaving, they say, would you like to leave a review on Yelp or Google? And I can click a link and leave a review just like that. I get messages, hey, we haven't seen you in a while. Would you like a discount on ice cream? Yes. It is a great way to stay in touch with your customers, because text messaging is much more effective. It's what your customers want. It's kind of a habit we learned during the pandemic. So much better than playing phone tag. There aren't enough hours in the day for that. Podium makes every interaction as easy as sending a text. So everything that makes your business great can get done faster. I notice, for instance, when we need somebody to do something around the house, the one that gets the job is the one that texts me back fastest. I love that. Podium isn't just a better way to communicate. It's a better way to do everything. You can get reviews. Yes, you can collect payments through Podium. You can market to your customers. Podium makes it all as easy as pressing send. You won't just free up more time. You'll grow your business. You'll get more done. With Podium, you'll close deal with customers before the competition even has a chance to call them back. And I know that's a case because it happens to me all the time. Join more than 100,000 businesses that already use Podium to streamline their customer interaction. Get started for free. Podium, P-O-D-I-U-M, podium.com/twit. If you sign up for a paid Podium account, you can get a free credit card reader as well. Restrictions apply. That's podium.com/twit. We thank them so much for supporting our show, and thank you for supporting it by using that address, podium.com/twit. One more Elon. I said no more Elon. I should mention one more Elon story. During all of this last week, a judge rejected Elon's bid to truncate, end its settlement, his settlement with the SEC. That's the one where he got in trouble for tweeting that he was taking Tesla private, funding arranged. The SEC said, no, that's not true, and you can't say that. Fine him $20 million. Fine Tesla $20 million. And furthermore, said that Elon from now on would have to have lawyers review every tweet to make sure he wasn't making illegal tweets. Elon says, that's a violation of my free speech. A federal judge said, no, it's not. You cannot complain that this violates your First Amendment rights. So a little victory, I think, in this case for the SEC. Let's see.
I mean, the point of a settlement is that it's voluntary.
Yeah, you right? settled,
The government
dude.
Didn't order him not to do it. They said, if you promise us you will no longer do this, we won't punish you for this rule you broke. And he was like, that sounds like a good deal to me. That is not a First Amendment violation. Yeah.
And then 4 years later, oh, I don't want to do that. Sorry, yeah. Elon.
Also, he's not supposed to imply that he didn't do the behavior that he agreed that he did, which is what he's saying now, that he had the funding, everything was fine, he didn't deceive shareholders.
Yeah, he's back to doing it again.
Yeah, is anyone paying attention to this pattern? Is, you know, in the Twitter boardroom? That's my question.
Apparently not.
Heavy sigh.
Apparently not. Apparently not. The Bored Ape Metaverse... it's at it again. a frenzy raises millions and crashes Ethereum. People buying plots of virtual land in a still unreleased metaverse featuring Bored Apes. This is from Yuga Labs, the creator of the Bored Apes Yacht Club collection. They raised $320 million worth of cryptocurrency, selling 55,000 plots of virtual land. Demand was so strong that the Ethereum blockchain was disrupted. I don't know. Maybe there's nothing to say about that. That story speaks for itself.
Oh, I have so many thoughts.
Thoughts. Thought away, Mr.
If I may paraphrase Beyonce, I don't think you're ready for this crypto. I don't think you're ready for this crypto. I mean, it just shows you that crypto payments networks are not ready for prime time. Like, they're not ready for a serious business. Bored Ape, which has promoted the heck out of its NFTs, you know, they swamped the system. That's, you know, that's pretty straightforward. But wouldn't they have thought about that? Wouldn't they have thought what a successful sale would look like and modeled out how that would impact gas fees?
Yeah.
But they didn't.
Did gas fees go through the roof because of it?
Yeah. They did, and in fact, I think they, if I read this correctly, they temporarily stopped sales on Ethereum because they saw the effect it was having.
Transaction costs just to mint other deed NFTs after the launch. Now, the plot of land itself was worth about $5,800 of Ethereum. The gas fees, the fee to make that transaction, $6,000. To Ether. And so obviously that's a disruption. If you have to, it costs you more money to make the transaction than pay for the transaction.
I mean, this is a fractally stupid story. So Molly White at Web3 is going great. Did a pretty
good
report.
What a great page. God bless you, Molly White.
Good.
Yeah.
And one of the things that she points out is that they actually did very explicitly consider their auction design and whether or not it would have an impact on Ethereum's ability to process transactions. And they discarded the Dutch auction plan, which I don't know if it would have been better or worse for Ethereum as a system, but they discarded it because they said it would be too hard on their network. And they explicitly chose this mechanism because they thought it would be better for the financial processing system underpinning it. But, I mean, all of this is really awful, right? So they're selling plots of land for a game that doesn't exist, and which may never exist. So this is very selling the Brooklyn Bridge. But their whole pitch, this pitch that Bored Apes are, you know, are the vanguard of NFTs, and NFTs are the vanguard of revitalizing the art market by decentralizing it, is a really like disingenuous pitch, because no one who owns a Bored Ape could tell you who the artist was behind it. There are no royalties for those artists. These are works made for hire. They are the artists who did make it. The primary artist is a woman of color. Are struggling to capitalize on any of this. They're really just faceless entities behind the curtain there. And so the all of the promises that are made about this just are literal like errant nonsense that is indefensible and inarguably wrong. And, you know, that's, you know, you land on top of that with, we are such financial geniuses that we'll come up with an auction design or a sale design that won't crash Ethereum, that promptly crashes Ethereum. And, you know, and then on top of that, all this business about them getting doxxed, where like a journalist went and looked up their financial filings, in which these people who have a multi-billion dollar empire, who are extracting hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars from investors and customers, without telling you who they are, but who had told a regulator who they were as a matter of public record, suddenly claimed to have been doxxed because someone looked at the public record and then threatened and harassed the journalist who did it. Like, you know, if that doesn't permanently disqualify you from running even a lemonade stand, let alone a media empire, I don't know what does.
Oh, there's so many things to be upset about.
No, you sound like my wife. Stop complaining, Corey.
Everything sucks. Anyway, I mean, if by now, if you're not, if alarm bells aren't going off whenever you look at an NFT or a crypto transaction, yeah, Web3 is going great. It's a great site to look at. It'll just give you some idea of what's going on out there. Web3isgoinggreat.com. And my favorite feature, we mentioned this on Wednesday on Twig, is over here in the lower right, this little tracker, which is the Grift Counter trademark. And as you scroll through the various articles, the grift tracker adds up the amount of grift involved. So by the time you get to the end of the page, which you probably will never get to, it's a significant sum of money going on. This is, if you read this, I mean, I feel like this kind of says all you need to know about all of this. Am I wrong, do you think, Owen, to tell people it's just basically a speculative bubble, a pyramid scam, and stay away? Do you have NFTs? Are you invested heavily in crypto?
I am a what they call a no coiner, and it's interesting.
What is that? I want to be that.
You have no crypto holdings.
Oh, I do have, actually. And I have a wallet I can't get into. Does that count?
That's a dough coiner.
That's a dough coiner.
But yeah, there's some people in the crypto world who will not talk to journalists who don't hold crypto, which is bonkers when you think about, like, you know, conventional.
You got to have a dog ethics in the hunt, otherwise your coverage will be way too
which is, you know, like, not the expectation that like a Tesla reporter would hold shares of Tesla, for example.
Right. It's the exact opposite, right? Yeah.
But I think that it is, I think it's fascinating that there are such utopian hopes around crypto, and yet the actual realities, when you dig into how many transactions they do a second, what the transaction costs are, that no one's actually designing these things to like work in the real world.
Right.
Like if you're not as good as Visa or MasterCard, why are you claiming to be a payments network?
Right.
Why are you claiming to upend, you know, the world of transactions? It boggles my mind.
Are you a no coiner, Tim, or get me?
I'm a some coiner.
Some coiner.
I have a few, mostly as an experiment, just more or less to kind of teach myself a little bit more about the network. So I do have some, but it's a fraction of a tenth
that's
of a percent
reasonable.
Of my
that's
holdings,
reasonable.
I think.
Yeah.
So that's about it. Yeah. I don't really have any large dogs in the game. I guess I have a few very small puppies in the game. but ultimately, I tend to share your thoughts on NFTs in general, Leo. I think that there are some legitimate applications for the technology, and I'm very interested to see where it goes. But 99% of what I see is basically grift and pyramid schemes, and finding that 1%, that nugget, I think is a very difficult thing. I'm curious to see what we hear from auto manufacturers all the time, who are talking about doing things like parts verification on blockchain and things like that, which
that
I think
makes sense.
Have some interesting applications,
yeah,
where you could really validate the supply chain of a given product, both in terms of, you know, for a classic car, making sure that everything is valid, but also in terms of making sure that your battery materials are sourced in an ethical way, or as ethically as they can be anyway. So I think there's definitely some applications like that on the business side of things, but from a consumer standpoint, from a, you know, sticking it to the man and coming up with a new way of retiring because 401ks are boring. That just really doesn't, I don't see a lot of validity there myself.
There was a proposal some time ago to put VIN numbers on the blockchain, and then all auto repair shops would add entries as they did repairs to the blockchain. That seems to me a sensible use of the blockchain.
It definitely does, but it also seems like something that you could pretty easily do with a good old database if you wanted to. You just needed to make it public.
Right.
I don't know that it needs to exist necessarily in the blockchain. But for sure, there are technologies like that which could make that fundamental technology behind crypto worthwhile. The Web3 stuff, there's definitely applications there. But yeah, Bored Apes,
not one of them. Corey, you seem like you think blockchain is not a panacea.
Tim just nailed it, which is what does the blockchain add to this? So I wrote an article about this called, I think, something like The Inevitability of Trusted Third Parties. So the thing is that VINs and repairs don't magically appear in the blockchain. As you said, if you were going to have a registry of repairs in the blockchain, you would need people to enter those repairs correctly into the blockchain. Otherwise, it doesn't work. So you're already trusting people to do that.
Anyway.
So if you've trusted someone to do it, do we think that the problem with existing databases of VINs and service that has gone on is that people change the database after it's posted? Because there are those databases. Last time I bought a used car, I looked up the VIN of the cars that I was looking up on them. Or do we think that the problem is that sometimes people just don't enter the data? And if they just don't enter the data, then having an immutable thing that they just don't enter the data into doesn't make them enter the data more. And, you know, more importantly, like, if you are going to trust, you know, we talk about these supply chain issues, right? Like, I just before lockdown, I was in Brussels for an event. And I met someone who's, you know, very sincere about this blockchain for good project that she'd worked on or run with EU money, where they were trying to guarantee fair trade produce. And so they were, you know, they would track the entire life cycle of a food commodity, like a bag of flour or a potato or whatever, and they put it in the blockchain. And I said, so I find a potato in the grocery store. How do I know it's the one that the blockchain is referencing and not a different potato? She said, well, you just have to trust us. I'm like, well, that's fine, right? Like, maybe you are trustworthy, in which case, why are we roasting the planet? You just tell me what I need to trust you on. And even if we're not roasting the planet, why are we, you know, even if you believe the proof of stake is not 6 months away as it has been for the last 5 years, but actually like imminent, then, you know, why are we entrusting it to a system that can only process 15 transactions a second worldwide for all users, like the Ethereum virtual computer, rather than just having it, as Tim said, in a database, right? If you trust someone to run the database, or if you trust someone to correctly enter things into the database,
because
then I don't know.
That's how we've always done it, Corey, and we want to do something different and new and futuristic.
So look, Pendlely ledgers are super cool. And I helped write up one that you use every day without knowing it. Speaking of supply chain, every time your browser gets a certificate from the world, it gets a signed certificate that's signed by the certificate authority that issued it. It makes a hash, signs it again, and uploads it to one or more of several certificate transparency servers around the world. These are not a blockchain. They're just Merkle trees. They're all over the place, and there are Pendlely logs. And anyone who wants to can subscribe to them and see whether or not a certificate has been issued for their domain that they didn't authorize. And this is a really powerful tool. I wrote it up for Nature with the guy who led the project at Google, Ben Laurie, who's a cryptographer, works on OpenSSL, a bunch of other projects. And it's really cool. And I do think public Pendlely ledgers have an application. But I think that that if we are going to talk about trust models, right, if we're going to say this is trustless, then it has to be trustless. And if you're going to introduce trust, if you're going to say there's a human oracle who could confound the entire transaction, who could break the entire transaction, you have to show why that person shouldn't just replace the cumbersome computing you're doing to get around having any human oracles in the loop. Otherwise, it just makes sense to have that person run the server too. You haven't gained anything new by it.
As you point out, a little mathematics, don't be afraid in your piece. If problem plus blockchain equals problem minus blockchain, then blockchain equals zero.
Yeah.
It's pretty, it's simple. It's math.
Yeah.
The blockchain hasn't added anything to the problem.
Not in those cases anyways. Yeah. I think there may be some in which it does.
But this concept of a append-only ledger means stuff can't be deleted from the ledger. You can only add to it. Is that the...
Yeah.
Basically?
Yeah. So you can add a later record, right? You could say... Well, you know, think about the deed for your
Twitter
house,
is an append-only ledger without an edit button.
Because
you can delete. You can delete.
Yeah. No, think about the deed for your house, which in theory there's actually like a piece of paper down at the whatever the Petaluma property registry.
Right.
And it's like literally a sheet of paper.
With all the
others. And everyone who owned your house, it says so at the bottom, right? So you can go back and see it. So you can add to the ledger. So it doesn't mean that once you sell your house, you can never sell it again, because you can append a new record to the bottom of the ledger.
Right.
But, you know, in this case, you're trusting the city to hold the deed and not go in and erase things or move things around and so on. And, you know, basically we build institutions to make that trust work, and they're not always great. And there have been ways in which they failed us pretty grotesquely. But the way that we make those institutions work best is by taking them out of the market. Right. The thing that actually makes those things work best is when people feel an ethical or a normative reason to do it. You know, the thing that keeps auditors honest is not the fear that they'll be discovered for colluding. It's their code of ethics. And, you know, when we turn everything into a financial transaction where we just say caveat emptor, if you can make $1 being the auditor and $1.01 cheating as the auditor, then you have like a moral duty to cheat. Instead of saying your duty is first not to money, but to your profession, then that's the way we keep our institutions working. You know, we can laugh at politicians who say, I'm a public servant first and, you know, here to earn a living second. But unless that's the way they feel, or unless that's the way a lot of them feel, the system does break down. And for me, the problem with the Web3 stuff is so much of it is grounded in the idea that we solve all of our problems by making them monetary, by just assigning values and selling stuff. And it explicitly getting rid of any normative claims about what people should do, and just saying people should do whatever the smart contract allows.
I think
right? we've designed the system.
I think that's
so that it works
that's where we are right now in end stage capitalism. If you stop worrying about
the triumph of Hayek.
Yeah. What do you think about Owen Thomas Fidelity's plan to put Bitcoin in your 401k?
Well, they are in hot water. Actually, we kind of called it in our piece on protocol.com, because we said, hey, you know, Fidelity is rolling out this plan. They're catering to MicroStrategy, which is a software company that has placed this really kind of, frankly, bizarre side bet on Bitcoin. It's not at all strategic to their software business. But the CEO, Michael Saylor, is a Bitcoin fanatic. Anyway, so Fidelity is making Bitcoin an option for MicroStrategy employees in their 401k. The problem is the Department of Labor, which oversees 401k plans, said in March that they were going to investigate any fiduciaries like Fidelity who put cryptocurrencies in a retirement plan. So Fidelity was setting itself up for an investigation here, and they knew full well. They had to have seen that warning that the Department of
Labor. They were applauded by, of course, a lot of what's the opposite of a no coin? A bro coin?
Yo coin?
Go coin? They were applauded by the Go coins for making this available to people. Now, the employer would have to do it, right? So I would have to, as an employer, say, hey, good news, John, you can add Bitcoin to your retirement. That doesn't seem like, on the face of it, a very good idea.
And that's the difference. There have been Bitcoin, like Roth IRAs, and those are self-directed plans.
Yeah. So that might not be so bad. Yeah.
I mean, you can put real estate in a Roth IRA.
No, that's how Peter Thiel has sheltered his fortune, hasn't he?
Yeah, you can put private equity.
If you have something that you think has a chance to really appreciate, you put it in after tax early in a Roth IRA, and then you don't pay any taxes on the appreciation.
But that's the difference under the law. A 401k plan, it's provided to you by your employer.
Right.
There's an implicit kind of recommendation there of the plan. And so it's got to be more conservative in what it offers.
Yeah. All right. I want to take a little break. Got to consider Corey's hips and all of this. I love it that he has – is it gold-plated or solid gold hip joint?
It's brass.
Brass.
It's neither.
So it's nice
brass.
And heavy.
So it's going on top of this cane here.
You could bean somebody with that.
I just need a machinist to put in a screw.
Yeah.
That is fantastic.
Oh, man, I love that. Everybody who gets hip surgery should save the top of the femur, get it cast in brass, and make a cane out of it. You could get a,
I mean,
be a business.
I don't know why you wouldn't.
Right. It's obvious.
Yeah.
John, I'm expecting
you. Would it offend your views of intellectual property to patent that idea? Because
that's the beauty of it. Corey has made it Creative Commons Zero. He is giving it away.
There's I got some folks here in Burbank who run a prop house that have a super high res laser scanner.
Ooh.
To do a 1200 DPI laser scan and put it on the Internet Archive CC0. So you can, like, at that res, you can blow it up to like room size if you want.
I'm on
archive.org. What should I search for? Corey's hip?
It's Dr. O'Femur.
I'm going to send that to my 3D printer right now.
I love that band.
Wait a minute. Dr. I'm sorry. O'Femur. My watch is about to call 911 because it thinks I fell. I didn't. I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt the show, but the watch was about to call 911. That's bizarre. All right. Here it is. Dr. O'Femur. No, this is Gold Genome's online database. I think I got the wrong thing. I'll have to find it later. It's on archive.org.
Let me see. Dr. O'Femur, Internet Archive.
Oh, maybe just use Google instead. What a thought.
No, that doesn't do it. Hang on.
Yeah, I see it. I'll drop it in the chat.
Oh, yeah. It'll take you to a Twitter link, which will then take you to the Internet
Dr.
Archive.
O'Femur. Internet.
Yeah, there you go.
Archive. I've got to see this. This is awesome. Okay.
It takes a while to load because they have a JavaScript 3D model thing. So it's going to, unless you've got a very fast computer, it might take a while to load.
Oh, well,
but if you
I
look
don't.
In that tweet, you can see some stills of it as well.
Okay, that's cool. There it is on Twitter. Look at that.
That weird thing that looks like a volcano coming off, that's the one tendon that they have to sever.
Oh, yuck.
Did
you sand that down or?
I did. I got it a little sanded down, not all the way down. I wanted to preserve it as like a memento mori there, but I got most of it taken off.
Oh, my God. I love it. Thank you, Corey, for being here. It's always a pleasure to have you on. Tim Stevens, great to have you. And, of course, Owen Thomas, our show today brought to you by Our Crowd. All around the world, tech companies are innovating and driving returns for investors. But you might wonder, you know, I've got my savings. I've been doing well. Well, how do I get involved? How do I get some deal flow? Because I'd like to get in on this exciting investment train. Well, Our Crowd is a venture capital firm, analyzes companies all across the global private market, selecting those with the greatest growth potential. But then they do something different. Instead of just putting their money in and sitting back to enjoy, they allow you to participate as well. Now, this is how you get into something that's not public yet, hasn't had an exit. This is really early, but that's the idea. Our crowd identifies innovators so you can invest when the growth potential is the greatest, from personalized medicine to robotics to cybersecurity. By the way, that is a hot field right now. Companies spend $150 billion annually on cybersecurity. I'm not surprised. Our crowd is the fastest growing venture capital investment community. Now, to do this, you have to be an accredited investor. This is not for everyone. So go to ourcrowd.com/twit. Once you enter the country that you're in, you could find out what the rules are for accredited investors, and then you can participate. I should also mention the minimum investment is $10,000. So, again, this is not for everybody. But if you've got your money, for your retirement put away, and you've got you're doing all the right things, and you want to have a little kind of fun finding out, participating, this is a great thing to do. By the way, it's free to join Our Crowd, so you can get the reports, you can get the information, and then decide on your own. Our Crowd's accredited investors have already invested $1 billion more in growing tech companies. 21 of their portfolio companies are unicorns already. Many of Our Crowd's members have benefited from over 50 IPOs or sale exits of portfolio companies. You can get in a single company deal for as little as $10,000. Our Crowd also has funds. The minimum investment there is $50,000. And again, investment terms will vary depending on where you are investing. So go to ourcrowd.com/twit, enter your country. As an example, though, of some of the deals, and you'll see these all once you join, you can see all sorts of deals. You can invest in Sotero. This is kind of cool. They've invented a patented approach to data protection that eliminates the gaps of traditional methods securing any data asset, whether it's on-prem or in the cloud. They already have as a customer one of the world's largest pharmaceutical companies, Sotero. But how do you get in? Ourcrowd.com/twit. Explore Sotero's potential. Join Our Crowd for free at OurCrowd.com/twit. Join the fastest growing venture capital investment community, OurCrowd.com/twit. OurCrowd.com/twit. I approve everybody we do ads for, and I thought I like this company. Because for years I've sat on the sidelines and watched people like Kevin Rose get all this, Jason Calacanis get all this deal flow, invest early on Twitter and Facebook. And I'm thinking, here I am, I'm sitting here. Now I can't do it because I'm covering the companies, and I'm with Owen here. I'm not going to invest in anything that we're covering. But I thought, this is a shame that only certain people get access to all of this information. I think this is democratizing. I like it that Our Crowd is doing this. So we're really happy to have them on the show. OurCrowd.com/twit. Corey's femur is still loading. You're right. My computer is not fast enough.
Well, it's a 1200 DPI model. Ah, so nice. If it were like a low res, it would load right away.
Doctor O Femur, public domain mark 1.0. Hip replacement anatomy, arthritis, hip capsule, and femur. Nice. You had this at Kaiser. They did it. So you could get, yeah. That's good to know. They do the coming in from the front thing there.
Yeah, they do the anterior approach, and they were really it was funny because they didn't know how to deal with it. My surgeon and his team didn't know how to deal with it, but apparently it's pretty common because what actually happens is you just tell them, and the pathologist saves it instead of putting it in the incinerator after they look at it.
Nice.
And my folks who came down to help with the post-op recovery just drove down to Kaiser the next day and went to the pathologist who gave it to them in a Tupperware. And he said, oh, we do this all day long.
Oh.
So I guess it's just the orthopedics department's not used to it. I think a lot of women save their placentas, for example.
Sure. I know that.
So, yeah, it was, I mean, why not, right?
Well,
I wish I had the foresight to save the other one.
Depends how much freezer space you have, I guess. Do they... this is indelicate. Do they clean it first?
No. Well, it gets wiped and Bactine before you before they operate on it, right? While it's in situ, they
clean it there.
Cover it in.
But did you have to then put it in a solution to?
It doesn't have any wet stuff on it. It has. It does have marrow inside of it.
Oh yeah, sure.
What I'm going to
that
do
cooks
now
up
that
real nice though. I wouldn't hesitate.
Yeah, well, now it's come back from the caster. I'm going to soak it in a peroxide solution and an ammonia solution. Then I'm debating, you can dip it in Mop and Glow to preserve it. That's a pretty common way of doing it.
Really?
I found a website for
Mop and Glow.
Removal surgery. So I'm thinking about doing that. What I really would like to do is preserve it in like methanol or ethanol, rather, on the back of our bar. We built this very elaborate backyard
tiki bar.
And
so yeah.
Having it float there.
Get one of those Frankenstein-style jars that you can just have it floating in. Yeah.
Next there's the a thing called the Sour Toe. There's a bar in Dawson City in Yukon, in the Yukon, where it's funny. I'm so trained not to say the Ukraine that now I don't say the Yukon. in the Yukon, there's this bar that, you know, is a prospector's bar. And then someone gave them his amputated frostbitten toe and they kept it on in a jar of alcohol in the back of the bar.
Sure.
And if you were drunk enough, you could order a sour toe and they would put the toe in a shot and you do the shot. And inevitably, someone drank the toe.
And
then one of their regulars willed them his toe when he died. So it's back on the menu. And we're thinking we might offer, you know, the sour femur in like a lowball glass in our bar.
Wait, I don't think that was in the John McGrew poem that I heard, the sour toe, the sour toe verse, but maybe they should add that. You were talking about how there's a public record at the county seat of everybody who's ever owned your house. There's a lot of public records, and there are companies out there who go around, send people to the county seats, record them, and put them online. So that a lot of people are quite shocked to learn if you search for information about yourself, you can find the home you own. You can find a lot of information. This is kind of a historic problem. You can go to companies like Spokio and say, take me down. But there's so many of them, you could easily miss a few. It's easy, in other words, to dox someone or dox yourself. Google has announced that they are going to allow people to remove at least the Google search result for personally identifiable information from Google search. I think this is a good move. There is a lot of different kinds of information. Obviously, governmental ID numbers, bank account numbers, credit card numbers, pictures of your handwritten signature, ID docs like your driver's license or passport, highly personal, restricted, and official records like medical records, personal contact info, including your address, phone number, and email address, or confidential login numbers. This is from a Google blog post on Wednesday. If you want to know more, you can Google. Google's always had a set of policies to do this, but it sounds like this is a little bit easier to do. Thoughts, anybody? I think it's Tim Stevens. You've ever done a search for yourself on Spokio and been horrified?
I have not, actually, but I definitely think this is a positive move. It'll make it easier for people to take a first step to keeping, you know, the basics of your information being easily found. I guess to me, I think this is kind of like putting a cheap padlock on something that you want to keep secure. It'll keep the honest people from getting in there, but anybody who wants in, they're going to find a way. They'll cut the padlock off. So, you know, that information will still be out there, obviously, and will be not that hard to find for people who know how to find it. But it will at least keep people from, who are only going to take the most basic steps in trying to find that information. It'll keep them from finding it easily. So I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, why put it in the Google search results? As Google points out, it doesn't take it off the net. You still have to go, and you should go to the site if you can to get it removed. Anyway.
I have a horror story about this.
Do you?
From when we moved to back to California from the UK, you know, we had a half container and the customs broker requires your passport. So I sent them a copy of my passport and they put that with the waybill on the outside of the container. And there are people who do market research at the Port of Los Angeles.
Oh, no.
Transcribe all the waybills.
They just stand there writing it down?
Yeah. So they're public records, right? And so one day, for some reason, I put my passport number into Google. I think I was just having a kind of paranoid moment. And I found literally hundreds of websites that had my passport number and my home address linked together because that's where the container was being delivered. So I actually have not used my home address for deliveries except for things like shipping containers for about 15, 20 years now. I rent a post box down the road because I've had problems with stalkers and weirdos and whatever. And yet there are some things like you cannot have your shipping container dropped off at the post box a mile away. You know, you still have to get it home. And I never got rid of them all. We moved and my passport expired. Like that's why I'm now
Holy
safe.
Holy cow.
Right? And it's pretty bad. I have a Google alert for my name and address. And whenever it pops up in a public search result, I go and ask the company to take it down. I do worry that if Google alerts were to leak, well, then that would expose a lot of my information. But if Google were to leak, it would expose a lot of my information anyway.
So far, to my knowledge, Google has never had a breach. They're pretty good at protecting your information.
Well, no, they were. I mean, they were breached by the Chinese government.
Oh, well, that's different.
Ben Lurie, the guy that I co-wrote that paper for Nature for, ran the forensics on the Chinese state hack.
Holy cow!
Yeah.
When was that?
And Google users get breached all the time. And Google's had a bunch of insider attacks.
Through their own errors or...
Yeah, and then Google's had a bunch of insider attacks.
Oh, they have?
Yeah, where they've just had, like, people following around. Mostly it's dudes creeping on women.
Oh, my God. All right.
I mean, a lot of these companies have it. Google's got actually pretty good internal access controls and forensics, as I understand it. There was an amazing piece in Wired about how Amazon, in order to enable the agility of its teams, had no controls over making whole copies of all of their user and or merchant data. And literally thousands of them were floating around within the company. Every team had its own local copy and there was no tracking and no forensics. And they have tons of insider attacks. They have people who are like selling to merchants how their rivals' products were performing, and they had people who were creeping on customers and so on. Amazon's another one that I think a lot of people get delivered to their home, and even if they have a mailbox, because, you know, it's, you order heavy things from it, or big things.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, and what's the point of paying for Prime and next day delivery if you have it delivered to a mailbox that you then have to drive to and you only go to once a day?
Right. Yeah, I have a post office box for the same reasons, Corey, but I'm afraid my OPSEC is not great. I have so much stuff delivered at home, it's probably...
You can put your name... You can do the put your name into Google with your address, put an alert up. It's not a terrible plan. Like, I've the only reason I'm talking about it in public is I've mentioned it to a bunch of security experts, and none of them were like, you're doing what? That's crazy. Don't do that. I know a security researcher who's at a high risk. He writes a lot about... carters, Eastern European carters, and he's had like heroin sent to his home by carters who then called the police. He's been swatted. And he, when he bought a home, registered an LLC out of state and then bought the house with his LLC so that it's not recorded. The deed recording just says that there's an out of state LLC that owns it.
So you put in the search terms, not just your name, you'd put your full address in the search term.
Your home address. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to do that. And then you get all the results. You can even get it as an RSS feed. So you just put it in your feed reader and watch the fun happen right in front of your very, very eyes. We thought that Spotify might suffer because of Joe Rogan. Not so much. Spotify's quarterly results are out. Even though they kicked off 1.5 million premium users in Russia due to the invasion of Ukraine, even though the Joe Rogan controversy caused a lot of high-profile people to say, well, I'm abandoning Spotify. In the first quarter of this year, Spotify gained 2 million premium subscribers. So you subtract the 1.5 million from Russia and you gain 2 million. 16 million ad-supported subscribers. Spotify is a juggernaut. Which scares me a little bit because I feel like they're a little bit hostile to a free and open podcast ecosystem.
Leo, I've got a musician friend.
And yeah.
He says just a couple years ago, his, you know, streaming checks were pretty evenly distributed. He'd get some from Apple Music, some from Amazon, some from Spotify. And he said in recent months, it is really consolidated to Spotify. Spotify is what is paying his bills.
I look at my kids. I have Apple Music. I have Google YouTube Music. I have a lot of choices, and they can be on my family plan. They want Spotify. Everybody wants Spotify. That's kind of depressing. Okay. Data from fake legal requests has been used to extort minors sexually. From Alphabet, from Apple, from Facebook. Essentially what happens is the bad guys, the stalkers, the creeps, pose as law enforcement. and send emergency requests to these companies. Snap's also in there. Twitter's in there. Discord's in there. These are fraudulent legal requests, and then they use the data to, you know, do their bad guy things. Any thoughts? It's all of these things are just okay. So
no, I mean, I got stuff to say, but I wanted to let other folks have a chance there.
Very kind of you. Alex Stamos says, I know emergency data requests get used for real life-threatening emergencies every day, but it's tragic that this mechanism is also being abused to sexually exploit children. He's former chief security officer at Facebook. I don't know what you can do about this. That's the problem.
Well, I mean, there is an argument that getting a warrant is really hard, and that's probably true in some places. We know it's not true in other places. So in some cases, these extraordinary data requests are really about a very minor amount of labor saving, you know, and it produces an enormous risk. So, you've got two different risks you're weighing, right? One is that you have these companies that have billions of users and have incredibly intimate and powerful pictures of our lives that can be used to really do enormous harm to us. And we create a system that is very easy to breach. I think there's something like 16,000, maybe 1,600 U.S. police departments. So there's just no way they're going to be able to identify all the different police emails and so on. And in fact, a lot of the forged requests came from real police emails because the police websites had known vulnerabilities and they were able to open a web shell and take over accounts or create new accounts. A lot of this was done by children who attacked other children. So it's like we're not talking about a high degree of security here that was being breached, right? This is really like a very beginner level
script
kind of security defects that we're backstopping this very powerful bypass with. And then against that, you have the security risks of making the police get a warrant. And because warrants are a lot harder to forge, right? Warrants are a lot more recognizable and standardized than a casual email from a cop that just says, you know, there's a bomb on the bus and it'll go off if it drops under 40 miles an hour and I need to get into Sandra Bullock's email, right? And and you just have to kind of
curiously specific, by the way.
Yeah. Well, we Torontonians, we stick together. So me and Keanu, we're like this. I think that the security trade-off is a bad one. And I think
the companies could say no, by the way. They are not legally obligated. If it's not signed by a judge, if it's not a legal warrant.
But they think blood will be on their hands.
Right.
Right? So cops are
That's the worst thing that could happen is that later there's a press conference saying, well, we went to Apple and they wouldn't give us this information. And as a result, a child has died. That's what they don't want to have happen.
And you know, we could make it. If we could show that it's actually too hard to get a warrant, we could make it easier to get a warrant. I'm not convinced it's too hard to get a warrant. Right. I think there is supposed to be some due process there. And I don't think that judges are like, you know, unduly skeptical of cops' requests for warrants.
Yeah, make it be the judge's decision, not Apple's or Snap's or Facebook's. Wake a judge up, say, Your Honor, we need this information. We need it now. Sign this. I don't think that's unfair or unreasonable to ask that. I agree.
Yeah. I mean, again, it will introduce a new security risk, which is the risk that it will take a little longer and there might be some emergencies that are harmed. But what we're seeing is the visible side of the security risk here. And it's only the visible side. We don't know about the invisible side, right? Like if your bank account gets cleaned out and you never find out why, maybe it's because someone got the information needed to socially engineer your bank by doing one of these requests, and you never found out about it.
Right. Oh, so it's not just social media sites. A bank probably is also.
Well, maybe, but I think the bank would probably say no. But when you call up the bank and say, hi, this is Cory Doctorow, and here are all the things you need to know to verify that I'm me, all of which were taken from my private account information called from Google and Facebook and whatever.
Right.
If you can break into my Gmail and get my all my correspondence with my bank manager, and you can say, hey, Fred, this is Corey. Remember last week when we were talking about the hot dog cookout? Well, anyway, funniest thing, I dropped my ATM card in the toilet. And, I'm on my way to the airport. And I'm sending my kid over now. Could you just give him another ATM card? Right? Like if you
like there's a lot of social engineering attacks,
right?
And semi-automated social engineering attacks where people are doing things like getting your password reset questions, so they're never talking to a human; they're just finding out what your first street was or whatever. There's a lot of that that is never solved. We don't know where the source came from, and so we have no way to know how widespread this is. And I'll remind you, the only reason we found out about this is because literal children had started to use this en masse, primarily to sexually exploit other children.
Good Lord.
And so there might have been other more sophisticated attackers who just like kept it on the DL.
Yeah.
And who might still be doing it, right? And we would never know.
Yeah. Yikes. All right, I'm going to save this one. We're going to take a little break. I'm going to save this one. All of you can join in. I have a feeling the science fiction author might have something to say. Scientists, astronomers are about to tell aliens where we are. For years, decades, we've been listening for sounds of extraterrestrial intelligence, radio signals, and the like. But there are some astronomers who think, you know, maybe we ought to be sending signals out, trying to contact these folks directly. Maybe we ought to take this into our own hands. What could possibly go wrong? Well, there are a few people who think it's not such a good idea. We'll get to that in just a moment. Tim Stevens is here. Formerly Roadshow, now CNET Cars. Is it CNETcars.com?
It is CNET.com/cars.
Much better than 1-800-CNET-CARS.com.
That still works, too.
No. No, it doesn't. Owen Thomas from Protocol, Protocol.com.
That's right.
Yeah, got to get it right. Great to have you. And, of course, Cory Doctorow's latest book. Well, what is your latest book? Is it the poesy book now?
No, it's How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism. But the next book, which is coming in September, is Choke Point Capitalism, which is the book I wrote with Rebecca Giblin.
Oh,
about
yes.
Why the creative labor markets can't be solved just by adding more copyright, why you need a bunch of other stuff like antitrust and contracting rules and transparency and accounting and all that other stuff.
Yes, we talked about that last time. That sounds really, really good. Our show today brought to you by Nareva. Speaking of sounding good, if you are bringing people back into the office, you're starting to use the huddle room, the conference room, you have people, but you also have people still at home. And if you're still relying on that crappy little thing in the middle of the table, you know those people at home aren't hearing what's going on. They're dialed out because it's impossible to understand. Or maybe you went to a big expensive AV company and got a complicated system with speakers and microphones and wires and DSPs everywhere, and they have to come in every time and calibrate the darn thing. And there is a third way, a much better way. It's Nareva. Nareva has patented their microphone mist technology. That means all you have to do is put in what looks like a speaker bar in your conference room. Big room, maybe two of them. It's got integrated microphones. The microphone mist technology on that speaker fills a room with thousands of virtual microphones so that there are no dead zones. Everyone can be heard clearly everywhere in the room, no matter which way they're facing. If they're social distancing, if it's a classroom, participants can just move around and talk naturally in the space, and remote students can still hear and exactly what's going on. It is a revolution in meeting room technology, and it couldn't come at a better time. You don't have to have any technicians. In fact, you could install this yourself. If you ever installed a soundbar, it's easy. 30-minute DIY job. Continuous audio calibration means your rooms are instantly and always ready with optimized audio. No outside technician is necessary. And management's easy, too. Your IT team will love it, especially if you have many rooms. The Nareva console let's IT monitor, manage, and adjust the system anywhere they are, even off-site. So there's no need for IT to go from room to room. Look how easy it is to install your new Nareva soundbar. So ask yourself, if you want to go with a costly and complicated traditional system, are you tired of the little microphone in the middle of the table? That's the worst way to go. Make the leap. Simple, economical, effective Nareva. N-U-R-E-V-A. .com. Nareva.com. It's the best way to do huddle room audio. They've got the patent on it, and it really works. Thank you, Nareva. for your support of This Week in Tech. You support us when you go to that website. Actually, I guess it's just Nareva.com. So you still support us by going there. So go ahead and do it. All right. ET phone home. Two astronomer groups are planning to send messages from the world's largest radio telescope in China sometime in 2023. This is, by the way, I think, Corey, isn't this the plot of the three-body problem?
I think so. Well, it's certainly, I mean, the plot's very complicated. It's a three-body problem. Chichen Lu's a quite a complex plotter, but that's certainly a plot element of it.
At the beginning, anyway, yeah. They're going to beam a signal of radio pulses over a broad swath of sky. They'll be on and off like the ones and zeros of digital information. The message is called the beacon in the galaxy. The first thing they'll do is send prime numbers, presuming that math is universal, and mathematical operators, then the biochemistry of life, human forms, and then the controversial part, the Earth's location at a timestamp. They're sending the message toward a group of millions of stars near the center of the galaxy, 10 to 20,000 light years from Earth. Now, the only good thing is it'll take them 10 to 20,000 years to get this, and I'm going to hope it's going to take them at least this long to come back. So we don't have to worry too much about this, but still, theoretically, is it a bad idea to say, "Hey guys, come on over. Let's get together. Let's talk." Corey, do you think about alien life, first contact, things like that in any of your books? I can't remember. You're not that kind of sci-fi author, I don't think. Uh-oh, you're muted.
Sorry. I thought Kim Stanley Robinson's book Aurora did a really good job of this. Sorry, I had my mic off there. I only think about it as a literary device. I think that the distances are really big. They're kind of buzzkill big.
Yeah.
Because they're 20,000
years. Yeah.
To go. Well, no, that's 20,000 years at the speed of light.
Right.
Right? Anything that comes back is not going to come back at the speed of light or any appreciable fraction of it. So we're talking about like significantly longer than like behaviorally modern humans have existed, at a point in which like it's just very, very, very far away.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's like these are interesting thought experiments, but and it's not like they're so far away that like our light cone doesn't intersect with them so that we can never in fact influence each other.
They but might be watching I Love Lucy right now. Well, no, they have to wait about 9,550 years from now. But
yeah, you know, I just don't think we're going to make contact per se. Like, I don't think we're going to have a two-way exchange.
Yeah. It's the Fermi paradox.
Yeah.
Any thoughts, Owen? Are you a sci-fi fan?
I am, actually. It's kind of what I'm saying with my brother, and he kind of has our childhood sci-fi collection.
Oh, that's cool. Oh, nice.
Yeah, so like visiting the Wall of Heinlein is, you know,
that's really
back
fun.
A lot of memories.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I you know, I don't know. I think that doesn't our atmosphere kind of radiate enough information to interested aliens?
Yeah.
That, like, hey, there's a nice, juicy oxygen, you know, oxygenated planet with water, and, you know,
and I Love Lucy. Yeah,
I mean, I think that we've detected planets that might be able to sustain life. So, if at our level of technology we can do that, if there's an alien out there with, you know, sophisticated technology, they've probably spotted us. So,
very famously,
I think they're worrying about nothing.
Very famously, Stephen Hawking, about 10 years ago, said, you know, intelligent aliens could be rapacious marauders roaming the cosmos in search of resources to plunder and planets to conquer and colonize. So maybe we shouldn't be announcing our address. Maybe, and see, here's the other problem. Maybe they're not so far away, but they could still intercept the message and maybe come visit us. You know, I'm not going to worry about it right now. Not yet.
Yeah, like I would really worry about climate change.
That's a little more concerning.
Worried about aliens.
Yeah.
Like, think what an amazing thing it would be if our race could endure long enough for aliens to come and wipe us out in 10,000
there
years.
You go.
That
we're doing our best to make sure we can't.
It would mean we gotten an extra 10,000 years above the current odds.
Excellent point. Let's see. Netflix had a very bad, no good earnings report. I should do, it's funny, I avoid this, but I probably should go through all of the earnings this week because it was kind of an interesting mixed bag. The worst news was Netflix announcing on Tuesday that, actually it was a week ago Tuesday, that for the first time in a decade, they'd lost subscribers. You know, 200,000 here, 200,000 there. Doesn't sound too bad. The stock market punished them. 35% loss, more than $50 billion in the day immediately after. It's actually continued to drop since. Netflix has started laying off people as if, like, the whole thing is folding up and going home. Netflix did forecast they'd lose another 2 million subscribers over the next 3 months, so that may be what some of this. But didn't Netflix have a great 2 years with pandemic? Can they go ahead, Tim.
I think if anything, as if we needed another indicator of just how speculative the market is right now, this was a pretty good one. Netflix has a kind of not great quarter, you know, some bad news, and everyone just drops it immediately. Stock drops 35-40%, something like that. I think that shows how much people are really looking for big continual gains, and ultimately, it does point to the fact that Netflix disrupted the industry. They were way out ahead, and now a lot of other competitors have caught up, and there are so many options on the market that it's not really sustainable for most people. So I know quite a few people, myself included, who are kind of floating between streaming services. They'll go here for a month or two and then jump over somewhere else for a while. And it used to be that Netflix was that one service that you needed to have on 12 months out of the year, but that's not really the case anymore. There are compelling options from other services. And Netflix.
Well, there's CNN Plus. I mean, who needs?
Yeah, some Oops. Better than others for sure.
Whoops.
You know, and I think that internally at Netflix, you have to remember that the execs themselves are heavily compensated with stock,
right?
And so this stuff really matters to them,
right?
But also, you have to remember that they're recruiting in extremely tight labor markets especially for technical staff and executive staff. And that they get an enormous discount on their wage bill, provided that they can convince people that taking compensation in stock is a good idea because it'll go up and up and up. And if it doesn't, then you have to pay cash, right? There's a reason that Facebook has failed in its engineer recruiting numbers for the last 3 years, like significantly, I think by about a third. It's because engineers don't believe that the Facebook shares that they're getting are going to blow up the way the shares that they might get from somewhere else might be. And so Facebook's cash basis gets materially worse every time their share price goes down. And then investors go, oh, well, with a bad cash basis, we should sell our shares. And then the share price goes down and they're in a kind of destructive spiral.
That's probably why it's important to pay attention to quarterly results. I mean, I don't care what the stock market says about a company. I don't think it necessarily jibes with how the company is going to do, but it does materially impact their ability to acquire talent. And in fact, that's one reason taking Twitter private might not be a really great strategy long term for Twitter.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I know we said we're done talking about Twitter, but there's a lot of reasons why a lot of employees at Twitter are unhappy with this, and there's definitely expected to be a lot of losses within Twitter if this deal goes through. And that's one of the main reasons that conversation has been hugely based on stock. And certainly there are ways to provide similar proxies for private companies, but certainly nothing as visible or as seemingly attractive to new employees as the good old stock option. And if that's not on the table anymore, how is Twitter going to continue to hire good people? I think for some reason that might actually be something that Musk is looking forward to, because one of the things he wants to do is cut staff, to cut costs. But in the long run, that's going to make it really hard for them to recruit talented engineers and keep them.
Yeah. Alphabet in a similar situation. YouTube ad revenue didn't go down. This is another stock market thing. It just didn't go up as dramatically. So that's considered a loss from the point of view of the stock market. Growth slowing dramatically on YouTube ad revenue. I think it only grew 14%, only $6.87 billion last quarter. But Wall Street wanted and hoped for more, and that's going to impact Google's ability to acquire talent. Maybe one of the reasons Google announced at the same time that they were going to spend $70 billion to buy back stock, which puts them second in the tech sphere. Apple buying the most stock back. Apple's a big believer in stock repurchases, then Alphabet, then Facebook in 2021. I'm curious what you think, Owen, about stock buybacks. Is that a healthy thing for a company to do? It makes shareholders happy. I guess it probably makes employees happy because it raises the stock value.
So there's kind of two schools of thought. One is that a stock buyback is just a sign that you do not know how to take that cash and invest it in new things that are going to grow fast.
That's $70 billion they couldn't spend on R&D, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, or buying things like YouTube, which they only paid $1.65 billion for and, you know, invested more money in it along the ways. But I think that's been a great deal for them overall, recent hiccups aside. The counter argument, and this is more of a technical thing, is when these companies are paying employees in stock, they're issuing new shares all the time to kind of satisfy that compensation.
That right? dilutes and the so stock, right?
That dilutes the stock. So to keep the kind of, the number of shares outstanding level, you know, in whatever range you want, you need to buy back stock. Because the share count keeps inflating.
Google had strong growth, according to Sundar Pichai, in Google Search and cloud revenue. He also said the Pixel 6 was the best-selling Pixel phone, which doesn't say anything at all, given how poorly the Pixels have sold in the past. Alphabet has 163,000 employees, up 17% year over year. So they
I
are,
say,
they
I like
growing.
My Pixel 6. It's a good phone. It's fine.
Yeah.
I think that one of the things that
it's not sexy. Seeing, that's why it doesn't sell. It's not dead sexy.
No. Yeah. I want a boring phone. I want a phone that just works every day, which more or less the Pixel 6 does.
Yeah.
I switched to it after I dropped my old phone in water and killed it. And so this is the first time I've done a phone upgrade in a long time without having a backup because I don't do cloud backups because I don't trust the cloud. So I had to manually reassemble this phone, and I'm getting all of the alerts that I'd already said yes to, and it's literally like whatever 15 years worth of Android use alerts that I'm getting, and it's so annoying.
Wait a minute. You're telling me that in the past your phone has been set no alerts, but now that you have a new phone, all the old alerts are coming back? It doesn't start from now?
No, I mean things like tooltips.
Oh, and like, all that all that stuff you hadn't seen ever. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And stuff where, like, I think they've since eliminated from the UI the ability to turn off certain kinds of nags. So, like, somehow I had Spotify configured before so that it wouldn't ask me to turn on Bluetooth every time I turned it on to, quote, improve service because I don't want Spotify to know where I am. I don't want they're using it for location services.
Right.
I use Spotify because I have the No Mic Sonos One systems, the non-spying ones, and you have to use something like Spotify for it. So I have it. I pay for it. And I don't want to be nagged to turn on this thing. And all there is like maybe later. There's not a never ask me. And there used to be somewhere in the UI a setting that persisted when I migrated between phones that let you turn that off. And that setting is gone. The ability to make that setting is gone. And so now I just get the nag every time I turn on Spotify, which, you know, it's just the last thing I want. It's really annoying.
But
I think the thing you're identifying here is that share prices tumble partly because of the speculation effect. I think that's absolutely right. And partly because of bad surprises, right? It's not just Google didn't grow as fast as they had before. It's that Google didn't grow as fast as they predicted. And I think this ties into the speculation question, because when you're speculating, you're just gambling on the future, and you're like, who sounds like they know what they talk about, what they're talking about? Well, Pichai sounds like he knows what he's talking about. Last 7 years, he's told us it would grow this much, and it grew that much. And then he doesn't. You're like, oh, maybe he just got lucky. I better sell some of my stock because, you know, he's just pulling numbers out of his butt, as it turns out, and he doesn't know what he's talking about. And next year, the earnings could be anything. They could be, you know, double, and they could be half. Who knows? Because clearly he doesn't know what he's doing. He's lost his crystal ball, you know. And I think that's what stampedes investors out of out of these big tech stocks when they fail, because they're, as you said, you know, their fundamentals are terrible.
Right.
For at least for Twitter and, you know, Netflix and stuff, their fundamentals aren't great.
And so, you know, that all of their value is people buying the stock and the expectation that people will buy the stock. And that's entirely driven by confidence and whether or not the executives are you know, baby Nostradamuses who've got their own little crystal ball that can tell you how their company will perform next year.
Typically, Apple does very well by, it seems like, sandbagging, always saying, oh, we're not going to do that well, and then outperforming the analyst predictions. And then everybody goes, see, they're even better than we thought. You would think analysts would start to catch on to this sandbagging, but apparently they never do. Apple revenue grew 9% year over year in the quarter. They sold a lot of Macs. In fact, one of the stats that stood out to me is 50% of the new Macs were sold to people who'd never owned a Macintosh before. That's very good for the Macintosh brand. But Apple shares did go down because Luca Maestri, Apple CFO, warned about supply constraints. He says could hurt sales between $4 and $8 billion. The shutdown in Shanghai, particularly hard on Apple. Actually, a lot of companies. And in fact, I think Pat Gelsinger at Intel said, don't expect this chip shortage to ease up until 2025. That's starting to hit the bottom line, too. You can't make them, you can't sell them.
I think the markets are going to start responding to the threat of the Digital Markets Act and the Access Act as well.
Interesting.
Yeah.
In a positive or negative way?
Oh, in a negative way, because it's going to be bad for their profits. It's going to be good for the world. It's just not going to be good for their profits. It's like the idea is to, you know, reduce their monopoly rent extraction by making it easier to switch. We were just talking about switching costs, right?
If
you can leave iMessage, you know, without losing the whatever color triangle that you get when you're on iMessage and not an iOS user.
I believe it's your blue triangle, and then it's green if you're Android. I can't remember now.
Right. It's a little black turtleneck. if you're all the stuff comes out in the Elizabeth Holmes voice. I just think that's gonna hurt them, and also the App Store bills are going to be particularly hard on Apple.
Yeah.
You're just going to have to, there's going to be other app stores.
Right.
And, you know, Apple, like, their argument is so weird that Apple users don't want this. Like, who is going to use this if not Apple users? It's not like the alternate app store is going to be a big hit among Android users because they won't be able to install those apps. It's literally what they're saying is like, you aren't an Apple user. You are a bad Apple user. You're like Steve Jobs and you're holding the phone wrong. You're buying your apps from the wrong store. You're trusting the wrong people. It's a very weird argument.
Yeah.
But I think the reality is going to be that very few people actually use
app
stores.
That's right.
It's going to be too much work. It's going to be confusing.
I just want to buy it with my fingerprint or my face. I don't want to do anything more. I don't want to think about it. In fact,
Apple going to be forced to open up all of those, you know, access points and APIs? Like, you're not going to have the same smoothness.
No, Apple will make sure you don't. The other day I paid with my Apple Watch for a burrito. And I told my daughter, I said, I feel like I'm not even paying for this at all. Like, it's just free. Apple's paying. That's what it's called, Apple Pay. Apple will pay. And the psychology of it is dramatic. When you take out that friction of actually opening your billfold and pulling money out, people buy more stuff. I'm convinced of it. It just gets easier and easier.
Leo, have you heard the story about Steve Jobs at the Apple Cafe Max cafeteria?
No.
So, like many CEOs, Steve Jobs took a $1 a year salary.
Right.
So whenever he had a guest and took them out to Cafe Max, he would offer to pay and get really insistent that that he pay because it was deducted from his paycheck, and because it was just $1 a year, he'd basically get the pizza or whatever they were buying.
For free.
And he's worth billions.
That is cheapskate, man. That is...
He loves getting free pizza from his own company.
From my own company.
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, well, I don't know. That's ridiculous. That's nuts. Snap is making this. What could possibly go wrong with this? Snap is making a little flying drone called the Pixie that can do selfies when you can't ask somebody to take a video for you. Available in the U.S. and France for $230. Fortunately, it's expensive, so I don't expect to see a lot of them around. There's no controller, no SD card. I don't even know how it could possibly work. There are four pre-configured flight paths. So I guess you turn it on, you say float, orbit, or follow. Press the button, Pixie takes off. When you want to stop recording, you catch the drone, which may not be easy, but you catch it, put your hand below it, and it just lands in your hand. I think this sounds kind of cool, actually.
There was a company, I think it was called Lily, that promised something like this. And it turned out that their demo video was completely fake.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Snap has a little more at stake. So
they say very clearly on this video, created with Pixie. So you better believe. That's kind of an interesting idea, I guess. 5 to 8 flights on a single charge. It's got a replaceable battery. Doesn't weigh very much. About 3 ounces, 4 ounces.
They did a skywriting campaign over my house yesterday.
Oh, really?
For this thing. Yeah, there's an Olympic pool across the street that I swim in every day because I got, you know, bad back, bad joints. And I was on my back and I looked up at the sky and it was one of those planes that does the, it does like dot matrix printing where it just shoots a puff of cloud and it makes a matrix of letters. And it was like, use Pixie, it's awesome, something like that.
Wow.
Take it with Pixie.
Well, let me buy one. Interestingly, it's going to take 16 to 17 weeks to get here. Maybe I'll have it in time for Christmas. That's the other thing, the supply chain is. I mean, we're getting used to seeing things like that now. Oh, yeah, you'll get it.
Leo, this is going to be devastating for influencer boyfriends. So all those boyfriends who are photographing those candid moments of their influencer.
They're out of work.
They are out of work.
They're been replaced by a Pixie. That's right. Wasn't there a whole account, Instagram account about the boyfriends who have to take pictures? So August 22nd, I will get my Pixie, and I'll tell you all about it.
And you'll fire your influencer boyfriend.
I will fire my influencer boyfriend. He's gone. He's history. Get ready.
I want to know if you can use it on not Snap. Like, if you give them $200 and whatever for this thing.
Oh, I'm sure you have to use Snap.
And then they decide you're a spammer and kill your account. Do you now own, a $200-and-something brick?
See, this is how Corey thinks, ladies and gentlemen. This is why he's such a bitter, unhappy human being. Just enjoy the consumer society as it was intended.
Well, this is what happened with people who bought, you know, Facebook's Face Bricks.
Yeah.
Right?
The Quest. I don't have a Quest because I don't have a Facebook account. And right. I'm not going to create one just so I can get a Quest. And you're right. If you, for some reason, got booted off of Facebook, your Quest would stop working. That's crazy.
And, you know, back to Elon and his weird business plans. Like, imagine if your switching cost, if you left Facebook, was a bunch of proprietary hardware that you bought that would only work with, or if you left Twitter, rather, it was a bunch of proprietary hardware that only worked with Twitter, right? So someone buys Snap and says, oh, we got a certain fraction of our users that have sunk $200 into being a Snap user. We can probably charge them, you know, X dollars before they're like, I guess I'll give up that $200 investment. And if we keep it below there, we can just melt them for it. And the more stuff we sell them that's locked to our platform, the more we can mistreat them before they leave.
I fell for it. Oh, well. I think I have a Snap account. I'm not sure.
You've been permabanned.
I probably have. Fort Worth, the first city in the U.S. to mine Bitcoin. It's installed 3 Bitcoin mining rigs in the basement in the IT room, the climate-controlled information technology wing, which is probably just a room, of Fort Worth City Hall. The miners will be hosted on a private network to minimize the security risk. 3 Bitmain Antminer S9 mining rigs will run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Fort Worth mayor standing in front of them. She says, it's a gold mine. We're going to be rich. Or not. She said. They say that the mining rigs use as much energy as a household vacuum cleaner. I don't think there's going to be a lot of Bitcoin flowing from that Bitcoin mining rig.
I think they're about 20 years too late to get rich.
Yeah, they're not going to get rich on this.
Good to see our mayors laying in their strategic beanie baby reserves against future economic volatility.
Yeah. I'm planning for the future. Let's see. Okay, let's take a little break, and then we will have a couple of fun ones to wrap it up. TikTok, the number one app worldwide in the first quarter of 2022. Congratulations, TikTok. Are anybody, Curry, is there some reason to fear our new Chinese overlords with TikTok? Is there anything to worry about there?
I mean, I think that they are definitely supplying information to the Chinese state on the basis of lawful requests, and maybe even in the sloppy way that we talked about before. I'm sure there's an equivalent for TikTok. Something more interesting, there's a little European group called Algorithms Exposed. They're data scientists who crowdsource gathering information about how the recommender algorithms work. And they started it just to sort of figure it out. So you install like a browser plugin, depending on which services you use. There's one for TikTok, one for YouTube. There's one for Pornhub, one for Amazon, and one for Facebook. And it just feeds anonymized data into this analytical platform. And one of the reports they wrote was on how TikTok is performing in Russia right now. And they said it's created like a little pocket universe in which...
Because they banned, TikTok banned Russian...
Yeah, new videos from Russia. But the existing... So all that's circulating on Russian TikTok right now...
Is from Russia. You can't put new video into Russia. Right.
They're pre-banned videos about how Russia is defending itself against Nazis in Ukraine.
Oh, nice.
So that's it's a completely alternate universe. And, you know, that's something that Algorithms Exposed was able to learn by mining these algorithms. I think that there are pocket universes of all kinds. You know what Eli Pariser called the filter bubble, although that term gets thrown around a lot these days. I think that there's a lot of these little pocket universes that are created by recommender algorithms. Some of them are super benign. You know, if you like start in joinery and carpentry, you will find your way into the pocket universe of Japanese nailless joinery and carpentry. And from there,
that's
you
really
can specialize
cool,
further,
way.
You know, yeah, really yeah. specific kinds. That's awesome. That's the kind of esoterica I'm here for all day.
Yeah.
But some of them are less benign.
Right. Well, I just hope Elon doesn't ever buy Reddit. That's all. Because that's how I learn about things like that. I don't imagine he would. Let's take a little break. And our final ad of the day, we have a few more stories. We can wrap it up with our great panel. I want you to go to twit.tv, our website, and take a look. Let me just do it real quickly. At something we've got at the bottom of this, at the very bottom here, there's a little accessibility icon. This is from UserWay, and this is the sweetest thing. UserWay is our sponsor of this segment. This is the sweetest way to make the site more approachable, more accessible to everybody. If you click that button, you'll get an accessibility menu. You can also hit Control U. Allows you to change the contrast, to highlight links, make text bigger, change the text spacing, a dyslexia-friendly font, and a lot more accessibility settings. This is one of the ways UserWay makes websites easier to access all over the world. UserWay is a truly exciting company. Every website, according to the law, without exception, has to be accessible. That's one of the features of the ADA. UserWay is an AI-powered solution that enforces those web content accessibility guidelines, the WCAG guidelines, easily, in a matter of seconds. UserWay AI could do more than an entire team of developers could do in months. It's just one line of JavaScript. It may seem overwhelming when you first figure out that you need to make your website accessible or want to make your website accessible. UserWay solutions make it easy, simple, cost-effective. You can even use their free scanning tool at userway.org to see if your website is ADA compliant. And UserWay works with some of the biggest websites in the world. So if you have a giant enterprise-grade website with thousands of pages, they even have a managed solution where their team can handle everything for you. UserWay's AI and machine learning solutions power accessibility for over a million websites, including Twit, including Coca-Cola and Disney and eBay and FedEx. And now these enterprise-level accessibility tools are available to small and medium businesses as well. Of course, as you grow, they can grow with you. It is now the leading accessibility solution in the market, 61% of the market, the biggest in the world. I'll give you some examples. Motley Fool, you know Motley Fool, financial news and investment advisor, had 1,911 pages on their website. They were getting 20 million page views a month. They had designed the site smart. They were already structured for accessibility, but that was a lot of work for their dev team, spending a lot of time keeping it updated to the standards because the standards change. So they added UserWay as an extra layer of accessibility to make sure their browsing experience was accessible to everyone. That's what we've done. We make sure our site was accessible, but by adding that UserWay button, we just make it a little bit nicer for people with accessibility issues. For years, UserWay has been on the cutting edge, creating innovative technologies for accessibility that push the envelope of what's possible with AI and machine learning and computer vision. That's one of the ways they auto-generate alt tags for images. They actually have, they can write image descriptions for you with their computer vision. They remediate complex nav menus, ensure that all the pop-ups are accessible, fix vague link violations, fix any broken links. They can make sure that your website supports the full accessibility layer that all web browsers offer, including the use of accessible colors while remaining true to your brand. And you'll get a detailed report of everything that was fixed on your website. Works with everything. WordPress, yes. Shopify, Wix, Sitecore, yes. SharePoint. And, of course, with your own hand-coded site. That's how we're doing it. Let UserWay help your business meet its compliance goals and improve the experience for your users. The voice of Siri, Susan Bennett, has a message about UserWay.
Siri? Hi, I'm Susan Bennett, the original voice of Siri. You won't hear me say something like this too often. I'm sorry, I don't understand what you're looking for. But every day, that's what the internet is like for millions of people with disabilities. UserWay fixes all of that with just one line of code.
It's pretty amazing. One line of code does it all. And our web engineer, Patrick, will testify to that. It was a very easy fix for him to make to our site. UserWay can make any website fully accessible and ADA compliant. With UserWay, everyone who visits your site can browse seamlessly, can customize it to fit your needs. It's a great way to show your brand's commitment to millions of people with disabilities. You want to make your site accessible. I know you do. Well, here's an easy way to do it. UserWay.org/twit. You'll get 30% off UserWay's AI-powered accessibility solution. 30% off UserWay.org/twit. UserWay, making the internet accessible for everyone. UserWay.org/twit. And if you get a chance, go to the Twit website and click that widget in the lower right. That's pretty amazing. Even, frankly, I'm an old guy. I like the bigger text. I like that. You can move the widget. You can hide it. It's a great solution. UserWay, we thank you for your support and for this great accessibility menu on our site if you want to try it to see. A couple of final stories before we go to that, though, I forgot. We've got a great little mini video about this week on Twit. Watch.
There was a Pepcom event, an in-person Pepcom event. It's actually great for the press. It is
because they feed us.
Yes, yes.
But first time I ever saw a chocolate fountain was at a Pepcom showcase.
But it wasn't for sale, or you would have had
no, but you could dip anything into it and then eat it.
Doesn't work good with a cell phone. Don't worry.
No, I tried. No, yeah.
Previously on Twit, Tech News Weekly.
Snap has a new gadget that it's announcing officially. It's not another pair of spectacles for your face. It's a camera in the sky.
iOS Today.
Coming up on iOS Today, Rosemary Orchard and I have a special guest because we are going all in on shortcuts. So what does that mean? Of course, it means Matthew Casanelli joining us.
All about Android.
Android 13 Beta 1 is out. This is the first beta of Android 13 that doesn't require you to, you know, jump through hurdles in order to install it. I did this, and my device got wiped.
Twit.
Oh, nice.
Technology isn't always pretty, but we are.
Okay, so I'm glad he said that. I won't be installing Android 13 on my Pixel 6. Not just yet. I didn't finish all of the quarterly results. Meta, first quarter, pretty successful, generated revenue of $695 million. That's wrong. $27.2 billion. That makes more sense. But they did have a loss on their they call it the Facebook Reality Labs, the metaverse of $10.2 billion on revenue of $2.3 billion. But they knew that they, in fact, they estimated it would lose about $10 billion a year for some time until the metaverse actually happened. But the stock market liked the results. Meta's stock went up. Meta employees happy. Amazon didn't have a great quarter. Microsoft did have a good quarter. Actually, the most interesting story from my point of view of Microsoft is about half of its revenue came from cloud. Microsoft has become a cloud company. Are you surprised, Tim? You've been covering the tech business for some years. Microsoft basically has pivoted into a cloud company.
Yeah, a services company for sure. And that's definitely been something that a lot of people were predicting that they would have to do a decade ago. And we're concerned about, you know, with the operating system revenue really declining and ultimately going away. How are they going to be able to continue any level of growth? And they've done a remarkable job in being able to maintain that going forward. I'm pretty impressed actually at how well they've managed to make that pivot, because it's not an easy one. We've seen companies like IBM do it in the past with some degrees of success. And for Microsoft to go from a largely consumer-facing company with some business stuff to really pivot to being hugely business services-related, it's impressive.
Azure, 49% growth in the quarter. It is very impressive. The number of companies that have not made that kind of pivot, huge. In fact, the number that have, it's very rare. So good job. I think Satya Nadella deserves a lot of credit for that. Hollywood's fight against VPNs turns ugly. Now, film companies are accusing VPNs of enabling illegal activity. It's not just copyright infringement anymore. I'm sure Corey has something to say about Hollywood's war against ExpressVPN.
I mean, I've been involved with this fight for a long time. It doesn't surprise me. I think that, you know, the unwillingness to acknowledge how many powerful and useful things VPNs do, and the insistence that there's some magical way that you can design a VPN that only lets the good content through and not the bad content, is pretty nonsensical. And, you know, we are now at the end of the copyright experiment, and it's been pretty much, I think, definitively proved that the best way to fight piracy is to offer people content in useful wrappers that's easy to get at a reasonable price.
Without DRM.
Yeah, well, without DRM. And without, I mean, their big thing is release windows. They want to do regional release windows. I understand that. I have an American publisher. I have a British publisher. I know what that's like. But, you know, like expecting the entire world to arrange itself to your shareholders' convenience, and when they fail to do so, accusing them of felony contempt of business model, it's not an adult posture. There's no word for it, but childish as a way of thinking about how the world should work.
Oh, now they're saying VPNs are responsible for hacking, stalking, bomb threats, political assassinations, child pornography.
They said that about P2P. They said
that's
someday
right.
You download
BitTorrent.
An MP3.
Yeah.
And it's going to have a virus in the MP3. It's like, that's not how MP3s work, but you know, you do you, buddy. And then the virus in the MP3 would have your bank account hacked.
You said an interesting thing, though. We are at the end of the copyright wars. Do you think that's the case, that companies are realizing that? I know industry's abandoned it.
The thing that we're fighting over these days is automated filters. That's what they really want. So they just want YouTube-style content ID filters for all platforms. And then they want it to be set up so that, like, they feed the filter with the things that are prohibited. So no one else gets to feed it and block their stuff, but they get to block your stuff. And that what they get to do is replace all the limitations and exceptions to copyright, which are super important and just as big a part of copyright as the exclusive rights part, with a kind of fiat system where it's like, it's only fair use if we say it is. And since the whole point of fair use is it's all the things you can do without permission, that just effectively eliminates fair use.
And, you know, it's part of the extremely selective view that the entertainment industry has always taken of copyright. You know, you see Disney Marvel now fighting the original Marvel creators, including the heirs of Stan Lee, who are trying to exercise a bedrock of American copyright, which is the termination right, which is after 30 years, you can claw back the rights to your work and you can sell them to someone else. And they're basically arguing that they shouldn't have to respect copyright. It's never been about respecting artists' rights. It's always been about finding ways to secure commercial advantage.
So you're...
Go
ahead.
Doesn't streaming kind of make the old-fashioned file-sharing era copyright arguments irrelevant? Because, you know, really you're talking about not user-generated content like YouTube where there are questions about the rights, but, you know, it's just a package of content that Netflix gives you. They've licensed it or created it, and practically speaking, no one's trying to like grab it and download it. It's too much.
Yeah,
trouble.
Well, it's
when
just. Everyone who can afford Netflix has a Netflix account, and you know, we talked earlier about how some people are, you know, looking at the number of accounts they have every month and going, oh, no one wants to offer a bundle. And Disney decided to do this thing where they took everything out of Netflix and whatever, and then they bought all the media companies, so now I have to have D+, and it's all kind of a mess. And, you know, like the single biggest thing that drives people to password sharing and downloading on torrents is when the packages available aren't well arrayed and convenient and efficient for them. And as soon as it's convenient and efficient and well arrayed, most of those people give it up. And the ones who don't are super price sensitive and they weren't going to give you any money anyway.
I think that's right. Which is one of the reasons I think Netflix is smart with their password sharing strategy, which is instead of saying to the person who isn't buying Netflix but is using my password, we're going to cut you off, they just say to me, it's a couple extra bucks, just pay it. pay for your kids, come on. And that's that's not a hard thing to accede to, and it's I think a much smarter way of dealing with the problem.
Yeah.
Final story, because I know we want to get everybody out of here on time, but I do want to give a pat on the back to our good friend and regular contributor, Christina Warren, featured on NPR this week, because she apparently collects memorabilia from defunct companies that hardly ever made it. MoviePass, there she is in a MoviePass t-shirt. She recently got a pop socket for CNN Plus. She's looking for the Holy Grail, though, if you can help her out, which is any Theranos swag at all. She would very much like that. There she is wearing a Fyre Festival t-shirt. She's still pursuing her so-called white whale, which is Theranos. Anybody get... there's Enron. An Enron nice pad. Where'd you get that, Corey?
That's my friend Christopher Brown, the Austin science fiction writer and lawyer, who one day sent me like a letter or a package or something, and in it was a pad of Enron paper.
So that's real. That's not.
Oh yeah, no, that's actual Enron stationery.
Can't use that.
Whenever I write to my congressman, I write it on Enron stationery.
They listen. They sit up and take notice. Oh,
by the way, you know that Elizabeth Holmes' father worked at Enron.
No.
Oh, that's amazing.
Well, it all comes around, doesn't it? Oh, and thank you so much for being here, Protocol. Great publication. It's part of my regular daily news beat check, protocol.com, senior editor. And you don't charge a thing. I don't understand it, but you don't even have ads, do you?
Oh, no, we do.
Oh, you do.
Maybe you've got a blocker.
Let me turn that ad blocker off for you.
But we do appreciate your time and signing up for our fine, fine newsletters, including FinTech, which I oversee, and Source Code, which I occasionally contribute to.
There you go. Yeah, you may have ads, but they're not intrusive. It's a really great publication. And, of course, that's where Megan Maroney works, so we like it for that reason, too. Thank you, Owen. Great to have you on our stage this week.
My pleasure.
Also, Tim Stevens, he's the car guy, the editor-in-chief at CNET Cars. Anything going on at CNET Cars you want to talk about? Plug?
Yeah, actually, I'm heading down to Texas on Tuesday this week to drive the F-150 Lightning for the first time. Ooh. So we'll be driving Ford's first EV truck. The impressions are going to be under embargo for a little while, but we'll have that up on the site in the next couple of weeks so you can see what it's like to actually drive and even actually tow some things with Ford's electric truck.
First drive? I know President Biden got to drive it, but that's the only person ever.
Yeah, he got a heck of an exclusive there, so kudos to him. He's got good journalism chops, obviously.
I hope he was embargoed. I hope he had signed the DNA. No, I'm very interested in that. In fact, I think Jerry, our marketing director, our CMO, has put an order in. But nice. Now, if you're ordering now, are they going to start shipping soon?
They are. They're in production. In fact, they've just increased production. They just finally gave us the actual final horsepower figures and everything else. So they are in the factory coming out now. But if you haven't put your order in now, you certainly won't get one until next year.
He's waiting until next year. That's the truck that you can plug your house into.
You can. Or lots of other things, too.
Nice feature. CNET.com/cars, right?
You got it.
All right. Thanks for being here, Tim. Cory Doctorow, science fiction author, blogger. His blog is now at pluralistic.net. Highly recommend subscribing to the newsletter. It's a must read. And if you want to know more about his books, craphound.com is the place to go. I hope your hips are feeling better.
Thank you.
Anything you want to mention? By the way, regular user of Mastodon. You just did a 80s tweet thread, or toot thread, I should say.
I do all of the things that I post on Pluralistic also show up at the same time as a Twitter thread, a Mastodon thread, a Tumblr post, a Medium post, a Discourse post, an RSS feed, and a newsletter. So they all go.
How do you do that? What do you use to do that?
Manually.
No.
Yep. You know that scene in Batman, one of the Batman movies, where the Penguin is being played by Danny DeVito? And he accuses Christopher Walken of having done something bad. And Christopher Walken says, I couldn't have possibly done it. And if I had, I would have shredded the evidence. And the Penguin pulls out this sheet of paper that's just got thousands of pieces of tape on it. And he says, all it took was a little patience and a lot of tape. That's kind of how my workflow works.
Holy cow. Pluralistic. Yeah. He's on the Mammoth de France server, mammoth.fr. Here he is right here. Great picture of you too. That's great, Corey. And these tubes, what are they? What is that a picture of?
That's from the Computer History Museum. The last out of town trip I took before lockdown was to the Computer History Museum. And I got to visit their secret warehouse full of incredibly valuable, weird old junk. Nice. There's a lot of good pictures of it in my Flickr stream, all CC BY. So
I shall check it out.
Use them commercially if you need illustrate something.
Corey, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks, Owen.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim. Always great to have all three of you on. We do Twit every Sunday, round about 2 Pacific, 2:30, 5:30 Eastern. That would be 21:30 UTC. So you can watch us live if you want at live.twit.tv. There's also live audio streams there. If you're watching live, chat with us live at our free community-run IRC server, irc.twit.tv. A browser will work, but if you have an IRC client, that's even better. Of course, you can always chat with our Discord with all the other Club Twit members, if you're a member of Club Twit. After the fact, on-demand versions of this show available at twit.tv. There's a YouTube channel, and you can also subscribe in your favorite podcast client. Please leave us a 5-star review. Let the world know about one of the longest-running technology shows, now in our 18th year. That's a full grown podcast. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Another Twit is in the can.